Kingdom of Nye. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. First-time callers may reach Art at area code 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. Now, here again is Art.
Once again, here I am. Good morning, everybody. Coast to Coast and way beyond. This is exactly that, Coast to Coast AM, and I'm Art Bell. And here's what's going to happen this week. Beginning in a few minutes, a man who's been in aerospace most of his life, Mark McCandlish, will talk about new aircraft, propulsion systems, and a whole lot more. If you've never heard Mark, you've got a real treat coming up. That's tonight. Tomorrow night, we're going to talk to... we're going to talk to a very unusual man who's got a hole up in Washington, very near where Mel's hole was, and this hole, too, seems to have no effective bottom to it. At one point, I think they said they lowered 4,000 feet of monofilament and reached no bottom, except this time, guess what, folks? We have got pictures. Rob McCallum, the fellow who will be on here tomorrow night, was kind enough to provide photographs of the opening to this very obscure hole in Washington. By the way, if you want to see that photograph, it's up on the website now. All you do is go up to the website, scroll down to Rob McCallum's name, and click on it, and you will be taken to a place where you will see a photograph of this incredible hole. And it's been a long time since we've done a show like this, or since we've heard about a hole like this, and to have photography is an added boost. So that'll be tomorrow night. And then the next night, Dr. Ronald Klatz will be here to talk about, guess what, immortality. It is Dr. Klatz's position that if we can just live another 30 years, if you out there can hang on for another 30 years, immortality will be available to you. He'll also talk about cloning. Then Thursday night, Edgar Casey will be here. No, not the Edgar Casey. He has passed on, of course. But this is Edgar Casey, Edgar E. Casey, who is Edgar Casey's son. And he has written a book about Atlantis that you're going to want to hear. Then Friday night, Saturday, Dr. David Jacobs, who has just written he's a professor of history, by the way, at Temple. He's just written a book called The Threat. And he is convinced that indeed they, in quotes, are here, and that basically it is all over. So that's the week in brief ahead. Coming up, Mark McCandlish, but first I've got a little thing I want to read you that has been posted at a very prominent place on the internet entitled Art Bell on Government Black Ops Payroll? Question mark. If I told you I could sell you one light bulb, and in the life of that light bulb, I would save you $60 in energy costs, would you go for it? I can do it. This bulb will last 10,000 hours or 6 years of normal use. It screws into a normal socket just the way a regular bulb does. This bulb emits an equivalent of 75 watts of light, but it uses more like about 20 watts to operate. So you think about this a little bit, will you please? Each light will save over 500 pounds of coal needed to make electricity, but I think the more important point is yours, and that is one bulb, each one you buy, saves $60 in energy costs. And besides, it's better light. Buy one or more Philips electronic bulbs, and they're $29.95 each. I mean, buy one, you know, start with one. Prove it to yourself. I've got them, I know. Buy six or more, and the price drops to $25.95. Buy a dozen or more, and the price drops to $21.95. Call Bob Crane in the morning at 1-800-522-8863. Come on, do the math. Think about it. One bulb, $60 during the life of that bulb is what you will save. 1-800-522-8863. 8863.
If you're an investor who wants to make big money in the global economy, listen closely. The foreign exchange marketplace is 60 times the volume of the New York Stock Exchange. And unique financial concepts can show you how to take advantage of changes in the value of the U.S. dollar versus all foreign currencies, like the German mark, Swiss franc, British pound, and Japanese yen, for example. The U.S. dollar versus the Japanese yen. In a recent one-month period, the yen moved 10 points. Positioned properly, you could have made more than $35,000 with an investment of only $5,000. Get the complete reports and strategies. Learn how you can invest in the same currency markets that major banks and financial institutions use to make their profits. Call 1-800-934-1188. The information package and call are free. 1-800-934-1188. That's 1-800-934-1188. Of course, risk is involved and you could lose part or all of your initial investment. Only risk capital should be used. Past performance not necessarily indicative of future results.
All right. I've got a note here that I've got to verify. Art, have you heard about that comet slash meteor that exploded at altitude over or near El Paso, Texas, within the last 48 hours? News reports say that it was big, equivalent to several million tons of TNT. The news report on Como said had it made the Earth's surface, it would have been the biggest story, news story of 1998. No, I did not see that. The following was posted at UFO Mind Paranormal Research Index News Group, whatever that is. It's one of the bigger ones, certainly. And it's entitled Art Bell on Government Black Ops Payroll. Is Art Bell on secret government black ops payroll? Some question has arisen as to whether or not late-night radio talk show host Art Bell is on secret government payroll to air his show, which focuses more and more on UFOs, aliens, and wacko conspiracies. Scenario. A number of years ago, a talented talk radio host, who'd for much of his career lived in obscurity, always a local or regional celebrity, but not known worldwide, with a mediocre show, with mostly, like other talk shows, a political slant, then he begins a weekend show devoted to the paranormal, in particular UFOs and aliens. That show becomes quite popular. And said radio talk show host begins to move the topic to his weeknight show, garnering much interest, not only from the public, but certain people within the government. Let's not stop him, it is decided. Let's make him bigger for our purposes. Said radio talk show host is approached by someone with a large broadcasting company. Say the Chancellor Broadcasting Company as an example. That is backed by illicit CIA funds. Said radio talk show host is told that his show can be syndicated all over the country rather than stuck in one region, and that, quote, the paranormal stuff should always be the central focus. Said radio talk show host sees this as a golden opportunity. Keep in mind that disinformation is always a mix of the truth and lies. To keep those seeking the truth running around in circles and never quite certain what is true or what is not. Art Bell's guests range from the quite credible to the quite lunatic, and Mr. Bell never argues with nor agrees with his guests. He lets them talk. He lets his listeners make their own decisions. Many of his listeners, no doubt, believe what they hear. This format serves those special government people in other ways. They can keep track of what people, the call-in listeners, think and have experienced. And they can keep tabs on controversial people like Sean Morton and Richard Hoagland. Why is it that certain guests on Art Bell disappear? Or they come into harm's way, but Art Bell never does. Case in point, a man named Rodney had trapped a ghost and talked at length about it. The next day, he reported to Art Bell that some, quote, men in black, end quote, entered his home, beat him and his wife up, took their ghost-catching devices away from them. Then the man disappears, and Art is never able to find him. Second case in point, David Oates of Reverse Speech fame gets his house burned down with evidence of intruders after appearing on Art's show. Why doesn't Art Bell suffer any flap from the secret government that wants to suppress certain information? Callers on Art's show often asked him, "Are you afraid they're going to come to your door?" Art has always replied, "I'm not afraid. If they're going to come after me, they're going to come after me. But until then, I'm doing my own show." Art has also stated that he knows his phone lines are tapped. He said it on the air. "I'm well aware that certain people in our government service listen to this program." Of course they do. They want information. What better way to track down abductees and those who have seen UFOs and other things than a worldwide talk show with over 10 million listeners where the host invites people to discuss those kinds of experiences? What better forum to infuse disinformation among the masses who are interested in this subject matter? This isn't to say Art Bell is a knowing disinformation specialist or is knowingly on government payroll. He could have been duped with the idea of a large talk show. Or he could very well be part of this whole program. Two of his frequent guests are Linda Moulton Howe and Whitley Strieber, both of whom have been known operatives of the CIA on UFO disinformation. Radio disinformation has been used in wartime against the enemy. So has newspaper and TV disinformation, even to this minute. So, don't think the black ops government would pass a chance like Art Bell, do you? There's a reason why they let Art Bell live and do his show and sometimes release real, sensitive information. Oh, there you've got it. Somebody went to an awful lot of trouble to get all that down. So much for that. Do I deny it? Nah. I stopped trying to deny this kind of stuff a long time ago. You guys just keep the check here on time, and I'll be denying it right along. For the past 18 years, Mark McCandlish has worked as a technical illustration consultant to the defense and aerospace industry. Obvious CIA. A veteran of the United States Air Force, he was assigned to the 318th Fighter Interceptor Squadron and stationed at McChord Air Force Base, Washington, in the early 1970s, working as a weapons control systems mechanic on the F-106 Delta Dart. Later attending Art College, the Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, California, on the GI Bill, he studied automotive design and illustration. After a brief time working as an artist for a Hollywood special effects company, he was employed by General Dynamics Corporation, as a technical and conceptual artist and as a technical publications editor. During his career, Mr. McCandlish has twice held a DOD security clearance for secret material. After leaving General Dynamics in 1982, Mr. McCandlish became an art consultant to various defense contractors. Over the past 16 years, he has been privately informed by several aerospace industry employees that the U.S. military has been operating extremely advanced aircraft and spacecraft that have been kept secret from the American public. These vehicles range in design from advanced stealth airships using jet propulsion to exotic spacecraft using anti-gravity or electrogravitic propulsion systems. Mr. McCandlish believes that he has assembled enough technical data regarding the construction of a working anti-gravity propulsion system that he actually plans to build one in the near future. Here is Mark McCandlish. Mark, welcome.
Hi, Art.
Hi. Well, having read your background, Mark, you sound more CIA than I do.
Well, I've been accused of as much.
Well, I understand that's when you really graduate. When you get this kind of stuff posted about you, you really have graduated, Mark.
Well, in fact, I've even been accused of being a member of the so-called aviary of secret scientists trying to bring all this information out to the public.
How do we know you're not?
Well, because it came as a surprise even to me when when I was told this. But
yes, well, you see, that is exactly what you would be instructed to say.
Would you like to know what my code name was?
Look, the only way we can know for sure is if we shake hands, you know, the secret one.
Oh, the secret handshake.
That's
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Anyway, listen, enough of that.
Okay.
You had an opportunity to see a lot of advanced design aircraft. And I've always wanted to ask, and I will ask, I know where we are today. I mean, I see the F-117 headed for the Gulf. And that's a stealth aircraft. Can't see it on radar. I mean, that's what we've publicly got today, the F-117. The question is, what are they doing here close to me at Area 51 in Dreamland or wherever else they happen to be these days? How far ahead are we from the F-117?
Well, the general estimate that I've heard from a number of my sources indicates that some of the programs that are now in development or in progress or actually in deployment can be as much as 30 years ahead of what is acknowledged as current technology.
30 years?
Yeah.
30 years. I can barely imagine, in my wildest imagination, what 30 years would do to aircraft design. Maybe you can imagine. Maybe you know.
Well, you know, you have to understand that there are a lot of compartmentalizations that occur within the Defense Department, different companies, different programs, different experiments. And when you get various committees that come together and say, gee, you know, we've got this great project over here that's yielded 50% more lift out of the same kind of wing as we were using on an F-106 in 1973, and it reduces the drag on the aircraft by 20%.
Wow.
Enhancing fuel and range or fuel consumption, or I should say the reduction in fuel consumption and the range of the aircraft. And it's something as simple as having thousands and thousands of little tiny holes drilled in the surface of the wing by a laser.
Really?
And basically pumping air out into the boundary layer around the wing. Or sucking air into the wing from that same area to achieve different kinds of effects. You can do things like that.
Ooh, I've never heard of that before. That's a new one on me.
Well, you know, Stan Deo out in Australia is quite familiar with a lot of this kind of technology. In fact, as I recall from one of your previous programs, I think he even discussed the possibility of using electrostatic fields to achieve a kind of enhanced
yep.
airflow over wings and actually moving aircraft in that manner. And in fact, that very same technology has been described in the pages of Aviation Week and Space Technology as one of the things that they're actually using on the B-2 stealth bomber right now.
Now, the word on the street about the B-2 is that there's nothing stealthy about it, that the B-2 can be seen on radar, or that when it's passing through rain, it can be seen. I'm hearing a lot of negative things about, mm-hmm. about the B-2. What do you know?
Well, I've actually been inside the B-2 assembly facility at the Plant 42 Air Force facility
wow.
In Palmdale in the Lancaster area of Southern California. I've actually seen the aircraft undergoing construction, and I've been in on a number of presentations that discuss just this exact same kind of problem or allegation. There are certain types of high-tech radar, particularly radar that broadcast over a wide range of frequencies, ultra-wide radar frequency transmission does have the ability to pull certain features out of the B-2 bomber in terms of its reflectivity of the signal. And so there has been some debate about that. There do seem to be some ways in which this can be ameliorated or fixed in terms of the way that the wings are shaped or the way that the edge of the control surfaces are shaped, the kinds of paint and material that are applied to the outer surface of the aircraft. there are a lot of things that they can do. I mean, even some of the ideas that have been proposed sound like some of the stealth technology that you might have read about back in the 60s in Tom Swift novels, where they literally have receivers on one side of the aircraft that pick up the signal and transmit it out the other side of the aircraft so it appears as though it's not even there. I mean,
wow.
Some of the things are as far-fetched as that.
Well, you know that I saw something here in Nevada. I had a triangular object pass directly over my head at about 150 feet.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't fly, Mark. It was big. It was solid. It floated. That's the only word for it. Maybe doing all of 30 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Directly above me and continued out across the valley. And I could have thrown a rock at this damn thing. So that implies to me that we have propulsion systems that defy gravity. I don't know what else it implies. Unless this thing was from someplace else, then we've got anti-gravity. Do we have anti-gravity?
Well, the answer to that question is yes, but I don't think that what you saw was an anti-gravity propulsion system. Judging by the size of the vehicle as you have described it to me, or as I've heard it described previously on your show, I honestly believe that what you saw may have been considerably higher than 150 feet in the air, but because of its texturing, shall we say, and because of the materials that are used, it appears to be a lot farther away than it is, or a lot closer than it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
However, I believe that what you actually saw was a proof of concept vehicle based on some proposals that go all the way back to the mid-1970s.
All right, hold that thought, and we'll pick up on it after the bottom of the hour, which is what it is right now. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Kingdom of Nine. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Now, here's Art.
Once again, here I am. After reading that, I went into the other room and my wife wanted to know where were our suicide pills. Everybody knows anybody involved in the deep kind of black ops operations that obviously I must be in. Gotta have suicide pills, right? That's part of the kit. Then there should be three little black pills for our kiddies. in the medicine cabinet, huh? When you think about the future, do you see our economy getting better or worse? Well, the market, of course, was closed for President's Day, but it will open again later on tomorrow. And who knows, up or down? Maybe up, and up, and up, and up, and maybe one day down. Well, the irregularities of the market are of no concern to you if you know how to trade in commodities, which the media, I know, has kind of made a dirty word. I'm talking about gold, copper, orange juice, heating oil, beans, cattle, that kind of thing. For 3.5 years now, 3.5 years, a long-term sponsor, Ken Roberts has been successfully teaching people in my audience to understand the principles of making money through clear, decisive decisions in the commodities markets. He's got a very unusual way of teaching you, which is simply that you invest on paper as you learn, and only when you are personally certain that you're losing money by not using money, do you in effect graduate yourself and begin. I've got a lot of people that are working about 30 minutes a day, and that's it. They're gone fishing. Want to know more? The information is without obligation. It's absolutely free. Even the call is free. If you want to know more, call 1-800-GOLD-KRC. That's 1-800-G-O-L-D-KRC. Or the number is 1-800-465-3572. Well, all right, back now to Mark McCandlish. And again, the craft I saw, Mark, to me, you know, it was quite clear because there was nearly a full moon.
Mm-hmm.
It is, of course, difficult to judge distance and size, but this sucker was close. And when I say close, I mean almost throw a rock at it close. It really blocked out all the stars and the moon as it came over, that kind of deal.
Well, let me ask you this, Art. I mean, and this is something that I could probably discern from my work as an artist. If you were standing and looking at up at this thing and you spread your arms apart to indicate the angle, wingtip to wingtip or nose to tail on this thing, how far of an angle do you think your arms would make from a... From
you mean when it was directly overhead?
Yes.
Oh, boy. I would think that if I went at about... Let's see. I'm doing it on camera. I can't... I'll tell you what, Mark. Let's do this.
Somebody will think you're going praise the Lord, right?
Yeah, that's right. Look, let's do this. You're an artist, and I have been looking for somebody just like you. Between myself and my wife, I guarantee if we were to get together, we could talk you into rendering a precise drawing of what we saw.
I would love to.
All right, with reference points, land, the horizon, the stars, the moon, all the rest of it. So let's do that.
Yep, and you know what? When we're done, we'd probably be able to determine within, say, 25 to 30 feet of its actual length and width.
You see, my problem is I can't draw. I draw stick people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I need somebody like you, and if we can get together and do it, we're going to end up with some good conclusions here and a drawing.
Well, I'd love to, Art.
All right, good. All right, so...
I'll be your composite sketch artist.
Yeah, there you go. I've never seen it since, so the question is, what do you know is or is not currently going on out at Area 51?
Well, you know, they do believe that, or at least many of the watchers who hang around that area who've been out there frequently maintain that most of the really serious, highly classified activity begin to taper off around 1992, although there are still people who swear that they have seen lights and things zipping around the sky out there from time to time.
Oh, yes, yes.
Now, I have talked to a number of people that believe that the more highly classified material and testing has been moved to either northwestern Nevada or southwestern Idaho, in that general area up there.
Mm.
In fact, I know of a personal friend who, as recently as 1992, actually had a sighting of a 600-foot-long V-shaped boomerang-like vehicle that apparently was having some kind of flight control problems and was hovering at a very strange angle near Cedarville, California, which is up in that same general area. And in fact, if you drew a line from Redding, California, where I'm located, up through that part of the country, it would pass right through that same general area of northwestern Nevada and southwestern Idaho.
Well, I'll tell you, test aircraft do crash. Now, there have been a number of crashes near me,
mm-hmm.
side of the mountain near me, and when it occurs, Mark, you don't get anywhere near it. Even if there's a road, a public road that goes near it, everything is completely cordoned and blocked off. They bring in these big vans. A lot of interesting things occur,
sure.
But one of them is that you don't get to see a thing.
That's true. In fact, the pilots who fly these things are instructed that if they do get into trouble and it doesn't look like they're going to make it back to base, that they are instructed to auger this thing right into the ground at the highest velocity they can so that it's completely destroyed.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, when they go out there with a team to recover what's left of an aircraft, they will basically determine what the point of impact is, and they will sift the soil down to 20 feet if they have to get every last particle of it, every last component that they can, principally because so many of the materials that are used in these vehicles that allow them this stealth capability are highly classified in the kind of materials, the kind of components that go in there. They just don't want the information to get out at all.
How interesting. There's another type of aircraft that I want to ask you about,
sure.
that I have seen evidence of out here, and I still don't fully understand the propulsion system,
mm-hmm.
but it's like a bunch of explosions or something, and as you see, instead of seeing a normal contrail as you would with a jet, what you see are these donut-shaped booms,
mm-hmm.
boom, 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 boom,
right.
little donuts. What's going on there?
Well, that particular aircraft was the earliest version of a family of aircraft that later became known in the media as Aurora. The very first version of this aircraft, in fact, the very first one that was ever seen was seen, around 1977, 78.
Not long ago.
Yeah, it was a Lockheed experiment. This particular aircraft had, if it were viewed from above, you would say that it had basically the plan view of a flattened out football shape. Except in this particular example, and this was something probably about the size of the SR-71 in terms of its overall length, probably about 80 feet long and 65 feet wide. But this particular aircraft had two engines, and it had both vertical and ventral stabilizers. That is, that it had a tail that stuck up above the aircraft and one almost equal in size that stuck down below it, just like the earlier CIA-operated version of the SR-71, which was called the A-12. Now, this particular aircraft, as it happens, was seen by a pilot who was flying a Learjet over northern Nevada about that time. And he came out of the clouds at about 10,000 feet, saw this aircraft below and to the left of him. And he called the ground controller that he was in contact with and indicated that there was traffic in his vicinity, and he wanted to know why he had not been alerted as to that fact. And the controller swore that there was no traffic in his vicinity, and so with that he said, well, the hell there isn't. He says, I'll tell you what, I'm looking at this black thing down here shaped like a football, flattened out, two tails, one above, one below. He says, no wings, a little bubble at one end for a cockpit. And he says, I've never seen anything like it. And with that, this thing banked away from him, hit the afterburners, and took off like a shot. And he was immediately ordered by the ground controller, who just happened to be at Nellis Air Force Base, to fly south and land at Nellis Field and to not step out of his aircraft until told to do so.
My, my.
And according to this story, he was escorted by military police from the aircraft and spent quite a bit of time in debrief. But he did happen to tell an artist friend of mine by the name of Hal McCormick. And so that's how I found out about that.
So do you have a good rendering of this?
I do, as a matter of fact. There was a black and white line drawing of this particular, or actually the production version of this aircraft, which did not have any tails at all, that was published, and I believe it was November 24th, 1990, somewhere in there, Aviation Week in Space Technology.
Oh, no kidding. Do you have Mark, do you have a website with any of this stuff on it?
Well, there is a website that has some of my artwork on it that I can give you the address for. It has a bio and my photograph.
Please, yeah, we'll get a link up right away. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, the address for that is the company is called Air Art Northwest. They sell aviation art.
Right.
You know, aviation prints, I do private commissions, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
It's on the World Wide Web, so it's www.air, followed by art, A-R-T, immediately followed by the initials N-W, meaning Northwest, and then .com.
Got it.
www.airartnw.com.
All right, got it. And we is that particular rendering up there?
I don't think that it is, but I can tell you, in order to actually get to the page that includes my work, you would click on to Fine Art Prints and then scroll down to the word McCandlish. And from that point, you should be able to find it fairly easily. But if you were to search for Aviation Week and Space Technology on the World Wide Web, there's a very good possibility that you might be actually able to pull up the page from this particular issue of Aviation Week. And I believe it was November of 1990 that this was published in.
Okay.
And they are a McGraw-Hill publication, by the way.
All right.
So that may help anybody who's searching the web for that. But
very good.
Going on with the description of the aircraft, if I may, the final production version was 100 feet long, approximately 70 to 75 feet wide, had the same characteristic football shape, although the front end of the vehicle was just a little bit longer than the trailing end of it. The vehicle has, I believe, four main engines. However, the inlets in the exhaust ports on this vehicle are highly unusual. This explains part of the donut-shaped exhaust rings and things that you have seen. Some people have even seen more of a transitional contrail where the vehicle has gone from one type of propulsion system to another, where it's been described as donuts on a rope.
It's got to get to a certain altitude before it can begin using one of them?
Altitude and speed combined.
Okay.
This particular aircraft has control surfaces along the leading edge, leading edges, and along the trailing edges, and it also has kind of a beaver tail similar to the B-2 bomber, sort of a little tab right in the very center that goes up or down.
I don't know a lot about aerodynamics, but I'm picturing a flattened football and trying to figure out in my mind how something like that can fly.
Well, it's all fly-by-wire. In fact, I've even been told that this particular aircraft has the capability of flying completely unmanned using kind of a military counterpart of the global positioning system that allows an operator sitting on the ground, say at Nellis Air Force Base or Area 51, to actually control this thing wearing a complete virtual reality headset, sending all the telemetry to control the aircraft via satellite.
Is it possible that in future wars we will fight that way, with some guy sitting in a console with a virtual reality headset and nobody at all inside the airplane? Are we approaching the end of the era of piloted craft?
Yes, we are. In fact, there's some indication that we may have already done that previously in the Persian Gulf War that occurred back in, 91, 92?
Yeah.
There were an awful lot of highly unusual sightings by military personnel during the war, including some of these anomalous white balls of light that would zip across the sky and stop on a dime and then take off in another direction.
Wait.
Speeds in excess of 5,000 miles an hour.
Whoa. White balls of light?
Yes.
This was during the Iraq conflict?
That's right.
I had not heard a word about that. Mm-hmm. White balls of light that would do 5,000 miles an hour, stop on a dime, and do what?
Stop and make a right angle turn or go off in a completely different direction. These particular vehicles, whatever they were, appeared to be functioning more in a mode of observation than actual weapons deployment. From the people that I've spoken to, principally the people that I spoke to as witnesses were people who were functioning as Marines on board the ships that were actually in the Gulf. Generally, they were people who were on the deck of the ship late at night watching the surrounding waters for terrorists or something similar to an Iraqi SEAL team trying to sneak on the ship to sabotage.
So mainly reconnaissance then?
Probably. In fact, many of the films that we saw of, for example, the one I think most people remember is the luckiest guy in the world whose truck crosses the bridge right before a smart bomb goes in and takes it out.
I recall.
Well, if you go back and you review any of those films, one of the things that you'll notice right away is the relative movement between the target and the vehicle that is shooting the video is almost nil. I mean, it's almost as though this vehicle, wherever it is almost hovering. And I think, personally, I think that's one of the big giveaways of the kind of platform that video was shot from.
Uh-huh.
So, but there's also a very strong possibility that, as I was starting to mention earlier, that the vehicle that was used was something more akin to a very high-tech stealth airship or lighter-than-air vehicle, or LTAV, as some people call them, kind of like a stealth dirigible or a stealth blimp for people who are not familiar with the term. But basically, it's a vehicle that's lighter than the surrounding air. It uses a composite material on the outside like Kevlar or carbon fiber. It's entirely invisible on radar. It can actually be used as a radar listening post because it absorbs the radio frequency energy quite easily. And these things can send back real-time information to the commanders in the field, either via video or just pinpointing the source of an anti-aircraft radar that they can then home in onto with a missile and take it out. which is one of the real benefits of stealth technology. If you have you know, an aircraft that can fly into an area and deliver a weapon system, like a smart laser-guided bomb or something, and not be seen on radar, it gives you a real psychological advantage against your enemy.
Yeah, we're being told that in the coming conflict, probably beginning in the next 10 days or so, during a new moon at some point or another, that the percentage of smart bombs and smart things that we are going to use, automatic things, is going to be probably 80 or 90% compared to about 5 or 10% during the Gulf War. That indicates we've come a long way, baby.
Well, the accuracy has been increased dramatically. I think that there's probably a lot more accuracy in terms of satellite surveillance. I have a pretty good feeling that not only do they know where the real chemical weapons and biological weapons are, but I think they have a pretty good handle on how they can get to them in terms of the kinds of weapons that they will have to use. But I was in a conversation earlier today with an individual who told me that chemical weapons actually are ranked a distant fourth on the list of things that they really want to go after. The first and foremost, apparently, is a new advanced technology that's being imported from the former Soviet Union. And it involves these so-called scalar electromagnetic pulse weapons.
Oh, no.
Somewhat similar to the ones that the Russians were offering to help Indonesia with in shutting down a cyclone over an entire area.
You bet. Remember that? Oh, boy, do I remember that. I had the newspaper article. They did indeed make that offer. To create a cyclone. Now, how the hell do you create a cyclone?
Well, cyclones and most weather type of formations are really just the atmosphere's reaction to different temperature and pressure gradients that go through the atmosphere. You've heard of storm systems being referred to as low pressure systems,
of
things
course.
Like that.
Yes.
When you heat up an area of the earth or the ocean and the air begins to rise as a consequence of convection, the heat causing the air to rise,
you get a storm.
Well, if there's a lot of moisture in that area, particularly like the El Nino condition that we see now, where the water over the ocean itself or in the ocean is quite warm, then when that low pressure system occurs, when that reduction in pressure occurs, it draws a lot of moisture into the upper atmosphere, and it does it very quickly. But one of the things that happens as a consequence of that is that it's the water evaporating and becoming a gaseous form, and that actually has the effect of cooling the local area down. That's why low-pressure systems tend to be cooler than high-pressure systems.
Mm-hmm.
High-pressure systems are just the opposite. When you have cold air at altitude that's sinking down and causes compression, and so they actually seem to be a lot warmer than low-pressure systems because there's less of this evaporative effect. But if you have a very active, very intense low-pressure system like a cyclone, one of the ways that you can offer to shut that system down is that you use a system that will broadcast or create a tremendous amount of heat directly near this system. So you have a way of short-circuiting, and you can also use this kind of system to create a tremendous amount of cold air directly above the cyclone, which will start to sink down upon it and compress it. And by compressing it, it actually sort of crushes the low-pressure system and causes the airflow to start going in the other direction.
All right, well, the Russians are saying they now have this technology, not something they might be able to do or anything in the future. They're saying they've got satellites up there now that can do this. Do you believe that?
Yes, I do. In fact, if you talk to the gentleman from Alaska who's been covering the HAARP project,
Dr. Nick Begich.
Nick Begich, I think that he will certify that the HAARP project can do almost exactly the same thing by stimulating the ionosphere.
All right, Mark, hold on. We're at the top of the hour. Scalar weapons. So, we may be concerned that the Iraqis, from our friends the Russians, may have scalar weapons. Wonderful. Just wonderful. I'm Art Bellin from the High Desert. Mark McCandlish is my guest on Coast to Coast AM.
In the kingdom of Nye on the Wild Card Line at area code 702-727-1295. That's area code 702-727-1295. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is, and my guest is Mark McCandlish, who has been in aeronautics and space for years and years and years. We now have a photograph of Mark McCandlish on our website, and we also have a link to his website, which has some very, very intriguing things on it. So what you might want to do is to go to my website right away and make your way down to Mark McCandlish's photograph and the link. And when you get there, what you will see is a little blue thing that you can click on. And when you do, you'll be taken to Mark McCandlish's website and an opportunity to view all kinds of photographs of very exotic aircraft. And we'll cover some of the things that are on that website for you shortly. Also, tomorrow night's guest, Robert McCallum, has the Devil's Hole photograph up there. We've got a seemingly endless deep hole that we are going to explore tomorrow night. We've got photographs of it on the website right now, so that's another good reason for you to go up there. And we have also found the link now to this this article accusing me of being in black ops, so we're getting that link up as well. So there's several good reasons for you to go cruising up to my website right now, which is www.artbell.com. We were in the middle of a discussion of scalar weapons when we broke for the hour with Mark McCandlish, and the fact that the Iraqis may have scalar weapons. So we'll talk about those more in a moment. Again, Mark McCandlish. Mark?
Hi, Art.
What in God's name would a scalar weapon in the hands of somebody who would use it not in a friendly way do? What could you do with a scalar weapon?
Well, it depends on the power source. A scalar weapon, as it has been described by the people who know about these things, is a device that, when used in its proper form, transmits energy directly through hyperspace, almost as though you've created an artificial wormhole, and you generate this energy, the scalar energy, and you direct it from two independent sources, both of which can be pumped from the same energy source. In other words, something like a nuclear reactor. Those two forces, those two beams, if you will, go through hyperspace and can be coordinated to basically join together and become an unleashing of that same amount of energy at the other end.
My God.
And this can literally be transmitted just about anywhere you want within the local solar system.
If you're able, define for me hyperspace. I know what space is. What is hyperspace?
Well, to put it simply, many people have seen the diagram of the way gravity affects space-time, where you have something similar to a pliable surface, like the surface of a sheet of foam rubber with a grid that's laid on it.
Right.
And you put a bowling ball that weighs a lot in that flexible, pliable surface, and it causes a depression.
Correct.
And that has been referred to as a curvature or a compression of space-time. Now, just the opposite is true. You can actually expand space-time, which would diagrammatically look like a spike that is rising up off the surface of that pliable cushion, as though you reached down, you pinched a piece of the cushion, and you pulled it up away from the surface, kind of like in the old cartoons where somebody would create a bump on someone's head and pull it up away from the top of their head, that kind of thing.
Yes.
Well, imagine then that if you could stretch that same chunk of space-time and you could pull it way over to another spot on the same surface and make it touch down, essentially the tube or the inside of this material that you have then diagrammatically pulled over and made contact with the same grid, that is representative of what would be called a wormhole. Now, in this case, what you're doing is you're taking a type of energy that is being broadcast in the form of a focused beam.
Right.
You are, and it can be focused or omnidirectional in all directions at the same time, but it is wherever the interference pattern of those two independent beams come together that it actually unleashes the full amount of the force that was pumped into the two individual broadcasters.
Have you ever seen, Mark, the video from STS-50?
Mm-hmm.
You have?
I believe that's the one where there seems to be something flying along in the upper Earth's atmosphere. And
no, that's 40. That's 48. This is 50. And in STS-50, one of the shuttle's external cameras, as they're coming up on the coast of, I believe, South America,
mm-hmm.
focuses for a good 5 minutes on a certain city. I mean, you can see, you know, you can see the outline of the continent. You can, and it zooms in, and you can see the lights of the city.
Right.
And the camera sits there for a good 5 minutes, Mark, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden you see this incredible blast of light or energy ball-like thing
mm-hmm.
flash up from the Earth. Into space,
mm-hmm.
and it's obvious that the shuttle was wanting to take a picture of this and knew it was going to happen.
Hmm.
Is that something that might be a scalar weapon?
Well, it's possible. However, the description you just gave sounds an awful lot like what was being described back in the 1980s as an X-ray laser that is pumped by a nuclear blast. This particular type of weapon system has the ability to deliver almost the entire energy output of a nuclear weapon via an X-ray laser beam. And the interesting thing about it is that the weapon system actually has to use the electromagnetic nuclear pulse from a nuclear explosion to stimulate the X-ray laser and fire it. But in the process, it actually destroys itself, too, which could explain the flash on the ground and then this incredible pulse of energy that zips out past the space shuttle.
There is no question about what I saw. Of course, I have no idea what it is, but I know that I saw it, and I have that tape now. What makes you think that the Iraqis might have scalar weapons of any sort? The Russians?
Well, this particular piece of information came to me just today, in fact, and it came to me from a source that is well-versed in this kind of technology, and at this point I'm not sure that it would be appropriate for me to disclose the individual's name. But as I was saying earlier, the chemical weapons are actually probably number four, a distant fourth on the list of high-priority targets that we're going to be concerned about in here.
Biological, certainly, and nuclear,
yes,
certainly.
And that's about the order. The scalar weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, and chemical weapons in that descending order. The nuclear weapons, we know that he has publicly displayed the fact that he has nuclear triggers. We know that he has been trying desperately to get a hold of weapons-grade material on the black market from people who were formerly involved in the Soviets' military programs. We know that both France and Russia have been helping him to, and in fact, I think even Germany has participated in some of the chemical productions and the facilities that help to produce some of the chemical weapons. But probably after the potential threat of scalar, high-tech scalar weapons, which, by the way, permit him to wreak massive destruction on the United States without ever leaving home.
How would that? Let me understand how that would be done. How would that be done, Mark? In other words, how would a scalar weapon deliver an impact or a destruction to, a U.S. city or region?
Okay.
From Iraq, how would that happen?
Well, imagine that you have a frog sitting on a lily pad in a pond,
okay.
and you want to pick that particular spot in the pond as your target.
Right.
Then you go to another spot, two other spots in that pond, and you drop a very, very large rock in the water. And this may be 100 yards away. but you drop those two big rocks at different spots, and you do it simultaneously, and you do it in such a way that when those waves that are the ripples that spread outward in a circular ring, concentric rings, where they meet, where that interference pattern meets, it'll knock the frog right off that lily pad. And that's essentially what a scalar weapon does, is it uses a nuclear power source like a nuclear reactor, and it pumps two transmitters with the power from that source. That power is then broadcast sometimes in the form of a beam and sometimes as a an omnidirectional signal. But the timing of the pulse is such that you pick your distant target, and the distant target is the point at which these waves, if you will, come into phase with one another and actually begin to reinforce one another.
Mark, does this have to be space-based, or can it be ground-based?
It can be either.
Oh, brother.
In fact, there's even evidence that the Soviets were using this back as early as 1964, right after the Soviet the missile crisis in Cuba. There are a number of earmarks, signatures, if you will, that give off the well, it will basically tell you that that kind of a system is used, and it was also seen in Vietnam. And one of the most outstanding signatures of this particular device being used is that all of the electrical systems in an aircraft or in the local geographical area fail simultaneously without explanation. And it's basically because the local environment is being pumped with so much air energy, it's exactly like an electromagnetic nuclear pulse. It can blow out generators. It can fry the electrical systems of an aircraft. It can even make the fuel in an aircraft explode spontaneously. And, in fact, there is quite a bit of evidence that TWA Flight N-100 may, in fact, have been hit with what would be
scalar
referred
waves.
To as an electromagnetic missile, yeah.
Good Lord. There was a whole string, actually, of very interesting aircraft accidents, one down in South America where the pilot lost all navigation ability.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of reports coming from planes that fly the northwest route toward Japan that have lost all navigation ability, even satellite. Yep. Which is virtually impossible. And you think it's this kind of thing going on?
It's very likely, and one of the indicators that that may be so is that the Soviet Union for a long time had a facility that was using this technology, and it was based on the Kamchatka Peninsula.
Right.
Which you may recall is the very peninsula that I think it was Korean Airlines Flight 007
was overflying.
Carrying Senator John Towers, happened to stray over because of a navigational error. You know, if you have an aircraft that is using electrical systems like that that strays into the beam path of a weapon system like that is being used, even at a low power level, it's possible to completely disrupt the navigation of the aircraft. In fact, make the aircraft think that it's somewhere else. But if you are in the process of stimulating an area with low power levels of energy emission using a system like this, one of the ways that you begin to acquire and determine the accuracy of your system is by creating a lot of smaller little disruptions in the environment, a power failure over Niagara Falls, an extremely a strong storm system that goes through Houston, Texas, an electrical power failure over an entire area of Hawaii, things like that. And that's one of the ways, particularly if you have observers on the ground who can stand there and watch what's going on and say, yep, okay, we're right on the money with this one, and they dial it in. And it's even been described as producing a kind of grid or a network over that overlays the United States that would allow them to pull up coordinates and target exactly an area that they want to destroy.
Mark, there have been several Western power failures where the entire grid went down virtually from Canada, way up into Canada, down into Mexico, affecting about the western third of the United States. And in each case, and there have been two or three of them, they have never really found the source of the failure. And the whole idea of the grid in the first place is to isolate a failure and not take everything down.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea failed miserably, and could this be one thing that would explain that?
I would say so. I would say that it is, and you're right. You're absolutely right. In fact, the only difference between the more recent power failures and the one that occurred back in, I think it was 1967, the power plant from Niagara, was that the grid system wasn't quite as effective on the eastern seaboard, and what happened was that many of the systems that did remain online became overloaded and, as a consequence, shut down and redirected the power requirements to other members in the grid. And they, in turn, became overloaded, so the whole system began to collapse upon itself like a house of cards. But the system, the failures, I believe there was a major power failure about 2 years ago that ran right through our general area here. And I don't think that it was weather-related.
Let me remind you of what went on, because I was on the air during that power failure, Mark, and I'll tell you what occurred. There were two reports of what people thought to be large meteorites exactly at the moment the power failed.
Two
of them, and they were seen along the west coast.
Well, that's a key right there. Two independent surges of power that are basically in the process of coming out of hyperspace and joining into what would be called a vector wave.
I'll be damned.
And unleashing that electromagnetic pulse on the local environment.
The average American person sitting out there right now is saying, give me a break, Buck Rogers City. This stuff really can't be going on. What do you say?
Well, I know it's unbelievable. There are a lot of people who discount the whole idea of scalar weapons and zero-point energy, things like that, that are all based on the same kinds of technology and scientific development. The Soviets, unfortunately, have been far ahead of us in this field for a very long time, and we're still in the process of playing catch-up. Now, the same source that I spoke to today indicated that there are several other countries that have this technology and been researching it fervently for a very long time, and I believe that Israel and France are at least two of those countries that have the technology right now. And the statement was made that they have actually saved our butt on a couple of occasions by basically picking up the signal that's coming out of the Soviet Union or from another source, and putting another pulse back into the signal so that it went back to the source and overloaded the source. And the allegation was made that this is the very reason that Chernobyl blew up, was that it was the power source for one of these scalar weapons broadcast facilities, and it was overloaded.
And it was turned back on Chernobyl.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
In fact, back in the early 1900s, Nikola Tesla was conducting experiments in the same kind of technology at Colorado Springs, and one of the significant events that occurred while he was experimenting with his so-called artificial lightning was that he was able to send pulses of electricity back through the system that overloaded and blew out the generators at the local hydroelectric facility.
If we assume, for the sake of this conversation, that the Iraqis have such a site or sites, you are convinced we know where they are. How good is our satellite reconnaissance? I've always wondered about that. We've got this Cage series of satellites and maybe even more by now. What do I know? How good is it?
Well, to respond to your first statement as far as they're actually having it, my source indicates that they will be online with this kind of system probably within the next 3 months, probably no sooner than 3 months. And so President Clinton has really got a window in which he has to act.
I think I understand. All right, Mark. Hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour here. We'll be right back. We've got plenty of time. This is radio. I'm Art Bell. Mark McCandlish is here. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Head back, don't look back, I love you.
Upon you, your duty's sweet, no matter. Get it off.
Talk with Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nye from outside the U.S. First, dial your access number to the USA. Then, 800-893-0903. If you're a first-time caller, call Art at 702-727-1222. From east of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, including Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, call Art at 1-800-618-8255. Or call Art on the wildcard line at area code 702-727-1295. This is Coast to Coast AM from the Kingdom of Nye.
And the reason I just put all those numbers out is that we are going to shortly begin to take calls for Mark McCandlish. Wherever you are, we're talking and we'll continue to talk for a few moments about scalar weapons. And then we're going to touch on anti-gravity. And then it's going to be your turn. Just tell them you want the Ultra Team. The one Art Bell has on his Hot Rod Metro. Call 1-800-627-8800. It's like a heart transplant for your car.
I can never get that right. My little Hot Rod Metro. That's true, though. It really is true. It goes over that hill now in fourth. It never did that. It always had to go to third. Occasionally in a full load, even second.
All right, let us pick up roughly where we left off from Dave in Milwaukee. The following: Art, scalar weapons are based on the work of Nikola Tesla. Could you please ask Mark to comment on Tesla's contributions to the area? So that kind of picks us up where we were, Mark. What about it? Tesla, well, what did he really do? It's hard to separate the myth from the reality with Tesla.
Well, one of the interesting types of electrical devices that Nikola Tesla had come up with was one that just about everybody's familiar with, but very few people realize that he was the creator of. It was a kind of an open air transformer that was referred to as a Tesla coil. It's the kind of thing that they used for special effects back in the 40s and the 50s for all the old Frankenstein movies in the laboratory, the mad scientist, the lightning bolts zipping across the room and that kind of thing. And
of course,
basically it's just a way of taking a certain amount of electricity, say you know, the kind of electricity you get out of the wall, 120 volts AC, and through a transformer, stepping the voltage up to maybe a couple 100,000 volts, but the amperage drops way down so that it really doesn't become any more dangerous than, you know, sticking your finger in an outlet.
Lots and lots of voltage. Lots and lots of voltage, no current. It'll stand your hair on end, that kind of deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things, one of the eventual developments from that kind of research was a discovery by Tesla that the Earth itself is actually in what they call electrical resonance. That just like sound and the ability to, say, make a tuning fork at one end of the table begin to vibrate if you strike another tuning fork and put it firmly on the opposite end of the table.
Right.
Forced vibration, I think, is the term they use for that. Electricity is kind of the same way. It's the whole idea behind...
Are you referring to the Schumann resonance frequency or what is said to be the frequency of the Earth itself?
Well, that would be one of the things that Tesla did some work with, and I believe that you are speaking about the same thing, if I'm not mistaken. But the Earth itself is in electrical resonance, just like being able to achieve the same kind of forced vibration in a tuning fork. You can do the same thing with electrical systems. It's kind of the same principle that wireless radio broadcasts are based on. You send out a broadcast of a particular frequency, like a particular frequency of sound in a tuning fork, and you have a receiver at the other end that is tuned to that same particular frequency and will resonate with it, and then that signal can be amplified and you get sound, just like the people listening on the radio now.
Okay.
Well, in the case of Nikola Tesla, he found that because the Earth itself was in electrical resonance, that there was a way to stimulate or put a pulse of energy into that electrical resonating system. And if you had just the right kind of transmitter and just the right kind of receiver, you could stick an antenna into the ground and have free energy right out of the ground.
All right, that was the good Tesla. The bad Tesla that I've heard about
actually claim to be able to create earthquakes. In fact, there's some documentation indicating he did create an earthquake.
Well, there is a device. In fact, if you write for the catalog that's available from the International Tesla Society based in Colorado Springs, you can get the original patents for the device. And it's actually a rather small device. I think it involves a sort of solenoid type of mechanism. And the idea is that you say if you have a brick building, that brick building has a certain resonant frequency. And basically, what this little device does is it's very much like a little electrically stimulated hammer that will pound on the side of the building, and then it'll sit there and it'll listen for the echo of that sound to come resonating back to the point of origin. And the moment that it does, it will begin to time that echo so that each time the pulse goes out again, it also strikes another blow. And so that each time it goes out, it turns into a feedback loop where you're getting more and more energy that is being added to that pulse and that echo, and it begins to hit the resonant frequency of the entire building and will cause it to shatter just like a crystal glass.
Good Lord.
Now, the same thing is true of the Earth. I mean, you have all kinds of crystalline structures in the crust of the Earth, quartz and other kinds of crystals, which, of course, produce piezoelectric pulses that come out during earthquakes. It's one of the reasons for the so-called earthquake lights. When you have this tremendous crushing and grinding pressure of quartz and other types of crystalline structures in the surface of the earth grinding against one another under extreme pressure, you actually get electricity that comes right out of the ground. And sometimes we'll even have the... In fact, there's some research now that some of the UFO sightings associated with earthquakes are actually a manifestation of this. It's almost like a ball lightning.
All right. I want to move on very quickly to something that I think is very exciting.
Okay.
Talking about anti-gravity, in your bio, last line, it says, last paragraph, says, Mr. McCandlish believes that he has assembled enough technical data regarding the construction of a working anti-gravity propulsion system that he plans to build one in the near future. You're going to build one, Mark?
That's the plan.
What is it you're going to build?
Well, you know, if you go back and you research the patents that are available through the patent office, and this is something that I've done not only through the patent office but through various publications, you'll find mention of the research that was done by a scientist by the name of Thomas Townsend Brown. He and a professor Bifield discovered something referred to as the Bifield-Brown effect. Now, this was actually discovered probably back in the late 1920s, early 1930s. In fact, there is some indication that Thomas Townsend Brown had some kind of intellectual correspondence with Nikola Tesla. But the discovery was that if you take parallel plate capacitors, that's basically copper plates that are separated by some kind of heavy insulator like glass or plastic or something of that nature.
Right.
And you put a sufficient amount of high voltage electricity onto those plates, with one plate being positive and one plate being negative.
Right.
Or a multitude of plates that are stacked up upon one another with the same kind of insulation in between, where you have
a layering
of negative positive, negative positive, negative positive. And you have one circuit that's basically dedicated to the negative side of something like a Tesla coil, and the other side being dedicated to the positive side of the energy circuit, that you can actually see a reduction in mass of the capacitor itself. It will begin to levitate.
Now, I believe there have been experiments already along this line. In Finland,
yes.
Was it? I believe the Finnish, yes.
Well, in Finland, what they were using was a slightly different process, and they were using a ceramic compound that involved, I think it was three or four components. I believe they were yttrium, barium, and copper oxide. It was a development, I think, that came out of the Dow chemical company a number of years ago. But they took three wafers of this superconducting ceramic material, found a way of suspending them in a very strong electromagnetic field that basically wrapped around this column that the three wafers were suspended in.
Right.
And then they spun the three superconducting wafers in opposite directions. The bottom one spun in one direction, the next one up spun in the opposite direction,
and then
the one above that spun in the direction of the original wafer.
And the net effect was?
The net effect was they were seeing about a 2.5% reduction in mass of anything that was located above this apparatus, including in objects that were several stories above it in the same building.
Do you believe that you have the materials that you would need to actually construct a working model of a propulsion system that would defy gravity?
Well, actually, as it turns out, this kind of goes back to Art's parts. You may remember Linda Howe's discussion about this laminated material that was made up of 200 micron thin layers of a magnesium zinc alloy that was 97% magnesium and 3% zinc.
Of course.
Separated by 4 micron layers of pure bismuth.
Bismuth, that's right.
Well, it turns out pure bismuth is almost the same sort of material that they make solder out of, the type of solder you use to make electrical connections when you're building an electrical circuit.
Yes, oh yes.
It has a very low melting temperature. It's the same kind of stuff that they use to seal up and repair radiators. Now, as it turns out, the question about Art's parts, as I recall it, was how can or who is who is making this laminated material? How can it be made? And I'd actually written a letter to Linda. It was well over a year ago.
You must know. Linda approached every national lab. Mm-hmm. Linda approached every manufacturer of rare metals, mm-hmm. and got absolutely nowhere. There were even a couple that tried to reproduce it without luck.
Mm-hmm. Well, as it turns out, I got out my Aviation Week and aerospace directory that lists all the different companies in the country that make different alloys and materials. And in fact, I passed this information along to Linda Howe also. And there was a company I found in Pomona, California, right near where I used to work at General Dynamics, in fact, that could get me a 200 micron thick, or that's about 8,000ths of an inch, foil that was 97% magnesium and 3% zinc.
Huh.
And so the only requirement remaining was to find a way to put that together. Well, if you look at bismuth as a material that has a very low melting temperature, all you have to realize is that if you heat it up enough, it's going to spread out into a very thin layer if you put it under a lot of pressure, say like between two steel plates. And so I initially devised a system where I would take bismuth in the form of a powder,
right,
and I would sprinkle it between multiple layers of this magnesium zinc foil. I would take a couple of heavy steel half-inch thick plates with a number of threaded holes around the edges, and I would clamp these two plates together using a set of heavy-duty Chevrolet valve springs. And I'd put it in the oven at 600 degrees, let the bismuth melt and spread out between the individual layers of the magnesium zinc foil.
Right.
And the added pressure of these high heavy-duty valve springs would keep the pressure on so that even after this whole lamination began to sort of sink down and squeeze out the excess bismuth, I would have, a nice flat plate made of this lamination. Well, it turned out a friend of mine gave me a subscription to one of these publications that kind of alerts the aerospace industry to all these new machines that are available and so forth. And here I found an information packet about a machine that will use a vat of any kind of molten material, whether it's metallic or plastic or whatever, and you can run rollers with up to 18 inches wide of any kind of foil or material that you want to down into this vat. It will quickly coat the upper and both surfaces of the foil, and then it gives you the ability to then combine that strand or that length of foil with other lengths of foil that are then pressed together through a set of rollers while the material that it's been dipped in is still hot and wet or molten. And so it gives you a much more efficient way of manufacturing this very same kind of material. And you could even gauge the thickness of the binder or the material that's melted and is distributed over the outside of the material. I think one of the things that Linda had been searching for was offshoots of the so-called vacuum vapor deposition process, where you put your individual layers of foil or the substrate material, as it's sometimes called, into a vacuum chamber, and then you use a high temperature, almost like an arc welder device, that sprays vaporized metal.
That's right.
Onto the material, and because the material, the substrate material, is colder, it basically condenses onto the surface of that material. It's
all right, you're gonna begin to lose people a little bit, because you're almost losing me.
Well,
so anyway, you construct essentially
the plates of the capacitor blade. The different capacitor plates are constructed out of the same kind of magnesium zinc lamination.
Let's say you got it all put together.
Mm-hmm.
Bottom line here.
Right.
What would you expect to be able to do? With regard to when you say anti-gravity, I mean, would you have a small device that would rise into the air magically? Would you have something that you could install into, for better lack of a better word, a saucer type vehicle, and actually lift off? What do you practically imagine could be done?
Well, the proposal, as I'm outlining it for my prototype, basically uses a 12-foot television satellite dish as the structure that the capacitor sections will be installed upon.
Right.
As you know, it's like a big umbrella. You have all these vanes that go out to support the structure of this dish. We'll divide each one of those little sections into three small, almost like pizza pie thin slices or very long isosceles triangles, and make each one of them a capacitor section, and then set up a high voltage source like a Van de Graaff generator, which is basically just a big fan belt on a pair of plastic rollers, and it has some copper wires that stroke across the surface of the fan belt as it spins at very high speed,
right.
And it creates static electricity. Well, you can buy one from Edmund Scientific for $400. It'll put out almost 500,000 volts. Now, if you run that 500,000 volts through a Tesla coil that jumps it up to over 1,000,000, now you're really in business. And what you do is you have a rotating spark gap at the bottom of this central column that houses your Van de Graaff generator.
Yes, sir.
And then you have a control mechanism that allows you to control where that electricity goes on the dish to each one of these little sections. If you want it to go straight up, you put the same amount of energy on each one of your little capacitors. If you want it to curve to the right or curve to the left, then you just create a way of giving that side of the vehicle a little bit more electricity, and thereby creating a little bit more of an electrical push, if you will, more levitation. So that is how you're able to achieve directional control, is by controlling the amount of electricity that goes into the different capacitor sections.
Now, all right, then what would you be able to lift?
Well, according to one scientist who I've spoken with, who seems to know a lot about this, it takes about 1,500 watts of power to lift 6 pounds. So if you're dealing with something that's 1.5, 2 million volts that's distributed over, say, 24 to 48 individual capacitor sections, all of which stores that potential,
right?
It may be possible to lift as much as 1,000 pounds and do it very quickly.
Straight up and
straight
out
up.
And out if you wanted to.
Yes.
Good Lord. When do you think you might get around to actually beginning construction of something like this?
Well, it could be sooner than you think. I've got a friend who's involved in, shall we say, some very, very big real estate deals, and he's in the process of putting together a multi-million dollar deal for an agency, and it looks as though I may have actually be able to piggyback a research and development grant right off of that particular transaction.
How much money and time do you need to do it?
I believe I could do it in less than a year, and I initially felt that I could do it for less than $10,000, but one of the things about the system is that you and this goes back to the whole Roswell story. Do you remember the story about how they found fiber optics?
Of course I do. You're going to have to hold on. We're at a break point here. Sorry. Yeah, that's right. Hold on. Mark McCandlish is my guest. We're talking actually about anti-gravity, about building an anti-gravity device soon on the cheap.
Kingdom of Nye, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. From east of the Rockies, call Art at 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, including Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, at 1-800-618-8255. First-time callers may reach Art at area code 702-727-1222. And you may fax Art at area code 702-727-8499. Please limit your faxes to one or two pages. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Now again, here's Art.
Once again, here I am. Somebody writes, scalar weapons, doomsday stuff, question mark, anti-gravity, can you imagine that? We have a man here who claims that with X number of thousands of dollars, maybe 10, 20, 30, I don't know, in about a year's time, he'll be able to lift 1,000 pounds off the ground with the only propulsion system being an electrical one, producing anti-gravity.
To lose, but the fact.
All right, I promise, we're about to go to the phones. I got this fax that I want to read. Art, please don't use my name. This stuff was top secret at the time. You know the government. I was also in the USAF in the late 60s and early 70s, worked Special Ops Wing in North Carolina. We had what was probably the first operational stealth aircraft, a C-130, with lead-based radar absorption paint, including the props, chaff dispensers, ECM, and the APQ-99 forward and side-looking radar from the F-111 connected to the autopilot for low-level flight. It also included a personnel extraction system called the Fulton Recovery System, to pick up special ops operatives in the jungle. These poor guys went into Laos, Cambodia, North Vietnam with Swedish weapons, no ID, jungle fatigues. We would pick them up by dropping a package to them with a helium balloon, lots of line, and a harness. What a ride out. You were in the Air Force at the time and know what you saw as our capability then. All I'm saying is that we were 20 or 30 years ahead of technology then, what we must have now would be really amazing. This scalar weapon you're talking about tonight is pretty frightening. Ed Dames talks about a scenario soon to happen where the upper atmosphere is damaged / burned and a great change takes place in civilization as we know it. Please ask Mark what kind of a mess this weapon or a weapon like it could do to our world environment. Mark?
Well, it could. It's conceivable that a weapon system of this kind, if it wasn't destroyed in time, could literally damage the Earth to the point where the polar ice caps would melt, the coastline of most countries would change dramatically. 75% of the world's population lives within 20 miles of the coast in just about every country that has an ocean a coastline. And you would see death, starvation, and pestilence like you've never seen it before.
See, now you're sounding like Ed Dames.
Well, you know, I have to admit that on occasion I listen to Ed Dames quite a bit. I've corresponded with him. I think that the title Dr. Doom is well deserved, and I've been skeptical on occasion. But at the same time, I realize that there are weapon systems out there that, if placed in the wrong hands, and believe me, I think placing something like this in the hands of Saddam Hussein is the biggest mistake that the Soviet Union or the KGB or the Russian government could ever make. And I don't care how much oil they'd get for free, it's a big mistake.
I understand. All right.
If it's okay with you, Art, I'd like to backtrack for just a second to tie up a couple of loose ends.
Yeah, go ahead.
That thing on the Aurora that was published in Aviation Week was actually published a month later than I thought, December 24th, 1990, page 41. A similar full-color illustration appeared also in the... about a year later, in the December 1991 issue of Popular Mechanics magazine, the cover story was top secret regarding the so-called T-3 top secret aircraft, and the Aurora illustrations appear on page 35 in that issue. Now,
all right.
You had spoken about donut-shaped contrails and things like that. That basically comes from the shifting from the internal engines that I described before that have trapdoor NACA duct-style inlets and trapdoor exhaust ports that all close up at the moment that it transitions from the internal engines to an external burning mechanism running across the top and the bottom of the fuselage of this vehicle are thousands and thousands of what look like fuel injectors pointing towards the rear of the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And when this thing gets up above Mach 2.5, Mach 3, you get a supersonic shock wave that forms along the leading edges and coming up over the top and the bottom of the vehicle. And where these fuel injectors are located, there is a ridge, and the shockwave separates from the surface of the vehicle at that point, and they basically spray a pulse of fuel into that superheated shockwave of air, and it explodes spontaneously, and it expands between the supersonic shockwave and the tapered afterbody or tail section of the aircraft, and basically squeezes it like pinching a wet pumpkin seed.
In fact, so in other words, you're literally propelling yourself along with explosions.
That's right, and that's what that pulsing sound is. Now, when these things are at altitude, the pulse may last for about 5 seconds. You know, it'll be a constant stream of fuel for about 5 seconds, and then there'll be a pause for approximately 10 seconds. Now, I've actually seen this thing flying over the Redding area, coming up out of Area 51, headed towards the Gulf of Alaska. Now, on this particular occasion, it was, I guess it was in 1993, 1994. It was right about the time that the North Korean president, Kim Il-sung, was on his deathbed, and the U.S. government was not certain what would happen as a result of his death, whether his son would take over, whether he would try to start a war with South Korea. And so they had these vehicles flying over our area approximately every 20 minutes. And then again, early in the morning, you could see them going back into the southeast from this area back towards Area 51. But that was one of the things that you could see even through the binoculars, was this fuel igniting with a pause of roughly 10 seconds in between.
All right, I've got a million people who want to ask questions, so we've got to do that. But I just have one more question for you, very short one. Mark, if you do virtually invent anti-gravity, what will you do with it?
Well, as it turns out, there is something called the X Prize. There is a foundation that has established a prize of $10 million, and it's even being sponsored by some of the people that are in NASA, like Buzz Aldrin, and there's another astronaut. I think his name is Lichtenberg. They are basically going to put a prize up for anyone who can assemble a team and demonstrate a technology, even if it's a spin-off of the older existing technology, that will make commercialization of space a viable business venture.
So in other words, you'll collect your $10 million prize and virtually give it to the world?
Well, you got to remember, I'm not the first one to do this. The military has had this kind of stuff since at least 1967.
Well, not that I've seen.
Well, you know, if you look at some of the, and you have to remember, there's a whole segment of this story that we've discussed on previous shows that we haven't even touched on here, namely the fact that I know people who've actually seen the saucers in hangars at Norton Air Force Base and Edwards Air Force Base and other places, dating as far back as 1973.
Well, then what the hell are we doing launching shuttles with liquid chemical propellants?
Well, it keeps a lot of people employed.
All right.
What was it Richard Hoagland said, that it's a great jobs program or something like that?
Well, of course it is. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Mark McCandless. Hello.
Hello, Art.
Yes, sir. Where are you?
I'm in Rochester, New York.
Okay.
Is this Corky?
Yes.
You're a polite host, and I'm not going to be so polite. Mark, I want to pin you down on your belief in UFOs and extraterrestrial technology.
Okay, go ahead.
You've kind of veered off every time you were pinpointed on it.
Well, okay, ask your question.
What do you believe in the extraterrestrial technology that we've acquired from the so-called Roswell incident?
All right, that's fine. Look.
Do I believe it exists? Yes.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I have... We were talking earlier about arts parts. A lot of this audience has no idea what those are. They were sent to me anonymously a long time ago. I retain some of them. Lindemolt Howe has some of the parts. And Whitley Strieber, nobody knows that until now, has a sample of this as well. It was tested by just about every lab you could imagine. And it looks like it's an anti-gravitic material. So... where did it come from? Well, we know it came from 1947 and from Roswell, or we think we know that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he said, he hit you straight up. Do you believe that we have alien technology that we have back engineered and we are using? That's a straight up question.
Yeah, I do. Absolutely.
Okay, well, there's no weaseling there.
If I could kind of elaborate, one of the ways that I tried to test the idea of the U.S. military having acquired so-called alien technology was that once I had been told in 1988 from a personal friend who'd actually seen this technology in a hangar at Norton Air Force Base during the course of an air show in which he was in the presence of Senator Alan Cranston and Congressman George E. Brown Jr.,
yes,
I knew then that obviously we had something that was fairly unique. He was even referred to as an alien reproduction vehicle. So my next step was to try and find people who claimed to be victims of the so-called abduction phenomenon, and without previously telling them what the technology looked like, as far as I was aware,
right,
asked them to describe what, if any, propulsion system components they had seen. And in every single case where I found what I believed to be a legitimate example of the abduction phenomenon, I had people describing a central column that was wound by copper coils that had some kind of a liquid or gas flowing through it. There was some kind of a flywheel mechanism that was either mounted halfway up the column or at its base, that there were copper coils that wrapped around the exterior of the crew compartment that was in the immediate vicinity of this column. And basically what you were looking at there are the primary and the secondary windings of a Tesla coil with some kind of a generator in the middle of that central column. Now, in the case of the military system, and I've acquired this information in interfacing with Dr. Fred Bell, who you've had on your show a number of times.
Indeed.
It turns out that the military version of this vehicle is a lot more sophisticated than what I'm proposing. I mean, it goes far beyond using a Van de Graaff generator and a couple electric motors and batteries. The military version uses a plutonium dioxide 238 power source, which when you have just enough material below critical mass, the radioactive decay of the material will actually cause a ball, say 11 and a half or 12 pounds of this material, to glow red hot. And you can generate steam with that. And when you generate steam, you can drive a turbine, which goes through a transmission, turns the flywheel to stabilize the vehicle, but it also drives a high-voltage electrical generator,
right,
that you then power the Tesla coil with, et cetera.
Which, again, is exactly what you described earlier as what,
yeah,
will be anti-gravity. All right, I interviewed Dr. Fred Bell, and I found him to be a fascinating individual.
Yes.
His claim is that he has built a time machine. Now, his claim further is that he took this machine probably 30 seconds into the future and operated it one time, and I said, Doctor, what was there? What was 30 seconds in the future? And his answer was absolutely nothing. Blackness. A void. Are you familiar with that aspect of Dr. Bell?
Yes, I listened to very intently to that program. In fact, he is in the process of putting the finishing touches on the publication of a new book. And forgive me that I don't know what the title of it will be, but I have seen some of his illustrations depicting the system that he created and described on your program. And there were some remarkable similarities between that and the system that I'm proposing as a flying vehicle.
How do you know that when you create this, Mark, you're not going to create instead something that is going to warp space and time, and you and a lot of other things around it?
Well, actually, that's the byproduct of the function of the craft. It does, in fact, warp space and time. In fact, what it does is it expands space-time below the vehicle and compresses it above the vehicle, and that is a byproduct of mass cancellation.
Yes, but I can imagine that if something is not quite right and the fields don't go where you expect them to,
that the thing could flip over like a top that's out of balance.
And, it could, and it could take you with it.
That's true.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Mark McCandlish. Hello.
Hello, Art. This is Brett calling from Ohio.
Yes, sir.
And I have two questions. He was talking about taking energy from the ground.
Oh, the Tesla business, yes.
Yeah, is that anything like zero-point energy?
Okay. Do you have another question?
Yeah, my other question is that I've read a couple of different stories about Tesla harnessing zero-point energy, tachyon energy.
Right.
And I was wondering if your guests knew anything about that.
All right. It's the same question.
Pretty much.
What the hell is zero-point energy, and how would you tap into it?
Well, first let me answer the previous question. Was he able to create a power system that used this? There are some people that believe that the tower, power broadcasting tower that Tesla had proposed and was preparing to build at Warden Cliff, New York on Long Island, was in fact going to be the prototype for such a system. Now, it's my understanding that one of the people who basically funded all of his experiments was J.P. Morgan, who unfortunately died in the sinking of the Titanic. And after that point, Nikola Tesla was practically penniless. So I suppose you can generate another conspiracy based on that, too. But the idea was that he was going to try and use the electrical resonance of the Earth and create basically an electrical shock wave that would then travel through the crust of the Earth. And if you had the proper device, the proper antenna, so to speak, that you could drive into the ground, you could pick up this electrical pulse or this reinforcing of the Earth's electrical field and tap into that frequency and actually draw upon it using...
So, Mark, in other words, the power was not coming out of the air. It was coming out of the ground.
Well, actually, as it turns out, the reason that you have electricity in the form of lightning bolts is because there is a difference in voltage between the Earth itself and the atmosphere.
Actually, I understand that lightning bolts go from the ground to the cloud rather than cloud to ground.
Well, I have heard that, although and I'm not a real expert in this area, but I have heard the same thing, although what I've heard is that the initial pulse appears to come from the sky, but the flow of the electricity is actually going from the ground to the sky.
Okay, zero point energy that is supposedly all around us all the time.
Okay, what is it?
Yeah.
The best way to describe that would be to say that all around us, between each and every one of the atoms in your body and the materials and the buildings, everything around you, there are spaces, and it's been referred to in quantum mechanics as space-time. It's kind of like a matrix, like a sponge. And even though you can cool things down to almost absolute zero. When you do that, there is still this minor amount, this small amount of oscillations.
All right, hold that thought. We will come back to 0 point after the break at the bottom of the hour, which we must make right now. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. My guest is Mark McCandlish.
Apollo gold, lips sweet surprise. Her hands are never cold. She's got Betty Davis eyes. She's got a music on you. You won't have to think twice. She's pure as New York snow. She got Betty Davis
eyes. And I falling in love with you.
With Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nye. From east of the Rockies, dial 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, including Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, 1-800-618-8255. First-time callers may reach Art at area code 702-727-1222. And you may call Art on the wildcard line at area code 702-727-1295. To reach Art from outside the U.S., first dial your access number to the USA. Then 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM from the Kingdom of Nye with Art Bell.
That's me. Mark McCandlish is here, so you know who you're listening to. For the past 18 years, Mark has worked as a technical illustration consultant to the defense and aerospace industry. A veteran of the U.S. Air Force, he was assigned to the 318th Fighter Interceptor Squadron and stationed at McCord Air Force Base, Washington, in the early 70s, working as a weapons control systems mechanic on the F-106 Delta, Dart, and so very much more. And we are talking about things, I understand, that stretch the mind a little bit, but it's good for you. Let your mind stretch. You know, there are about 5 storms stacked out there right now, waiting to come in and smack the West Coast. A lot of people out of power, a lot of people... Oh, as a matter of fact, we had a power failure here over the weekend of about 1.5 hour, hour's duration. And what did we do? Went in the other room and got the Beijing radio and the light and turned it on. Now, the Beijing radio is an AM-FM shortwave radio, a full 7-pound radio. It has a crank on the side, and you turn it for 30 seconds, and the radio runs for 30 minutes at full room volume. So it does not take a rocket scientist to understand that if the power goes out, this is the first thing you're going to want, you're going to run to, and if you don't have one, you're going to be sorry. And it looks like El Nino is going to keep pounding us right on through spring and summer until the fall. Who knows? We're in rather unknown territory at the moment. Now listen to me very closely. Bob Crane has a special one-night-only sale on Beijing radios. He calls them orphans. They went out to somebody and came back for one reason or another. These have full warranties, and they are as new. And ladies and gentlemen, they are $94.95. I repeat, $94.95. It's the full Beijing radio. It's a one-day sale only, limited to stock on hand. When they run out during the day, too bad, that's it. So listen to me closely. A one-day sale, the full Beijing as new. We call them an orphan, but they're as new with a regular guarantee. $94.95. Call Bob Crane in the morning at 7:30 a.m., and if I were you, I wouldn't wait. That's 7:30 in the morning, Pacific time, at 1-800-522-8863. 1-800-522-8863. I'm here.
assigned matter and energy, both wave and particle type characteristics, and that the electrons had to be restrained to particular orbits or energy levels so that they couldn't radiate away this energy. And they would usually, when they did radiate the energy, it was usually in the form of photons. Now, photons are like packets of light. They have no mass. That's a very critical point right there, and I'll come back to that later. But the idea was that this energy that keeps the electrons spinning around the nucleus of the atom has to come from somewhere. Well, some of the most recent research on this indicates that boiling up out of the vacuum of space-time are these subatomic particles, electrons and positrons, antiprotons, all these different subatomic particles. And you're basically talking about matter and antimatter that just seems to materialize out of nowhere. And when these opposing particles materialize, almost instantaneously, they are attracted to one another because opposites attract. Positive and negative charges attract one another, and so they annihilate, and they release this zero-point energy. That energy is instantly absorbed by the nearest group of electrons, which keeps them spinning around the nucleus of the atom and keeps them going.
Oh.
So that every atom is like a little gyroscope. And if you've ever seen a gyroscope, you know that once you spin that thing up to speed, it'll sit there right on the edge of the table and basically won't move.
That's
because,
right.
Because it's like the wheels on a bicycle. It keeps turning, and it wants to stay in that position, and it resists being pushed away.
All right. Now, what I've been told about zero point with regard to a propulsion system was that a spacecraft approaching the speed of light could use zero-point energy, in effect taking it in the front of the craft and expelling it out the back of the craft, virtually eventually reaching a light speed or beyond.
Well, actually, you're almost right.
Okay.
Very close. What happens is your system is like I was saying before, expands space-time behind the vehicle and compresses space. And in the process...
But the faster you're going, in other words, the more zero-point you would encounter.
Well, that's true. And one of the things that Einstein said was that it was impossible for a material object to exceed the speed of light because its mass, its weight...
That's right.
As sort of a layman's generalization, its mass would increase to the point where it was so infinitely massive, you wouldn't have enough energy to propel it forward. Well, the mass itself comes from this spinning of the electrons. And if your power system, in effect, absorbs that zero-point energy out of the vacuum before it has the opportunity to keep those electrons in the structure of your vehicle from continuing to spin at the normal speed,
right.
What happens is those electrons that are in all the atoms of your spacecraft and inside of yourself, they begin to slow down. They begin to drop down to lower energy levels. And as that happens, the mass of the vehicle begins to drop off.
Uh-huh.
And so the faster you go and the more interaction that you have with the zero-point energy field that's around the vehicle, the more of it that is available to be absorbed and exploited as an energy source to drive the vehicle forward. And at the same time, the mass of the vehicle is getting closer and closer to almost nothing. Even though the structure, the atomic structure, remains and is still there.
So the faster you go, the faster you go.
And the
less mass you have.
Sure. Yeah, so it's basically just taking the whole idea that Einstein had and turning it on its head.
All right. Very quickly, Art, I'm a double E. I've got some comments about what has been mentioned about the Tesla coil. I built a Tesla coil when I was in the ninth grade. I took first place in our state science fair. My dad was a PhD in EE and helped me. The actual transformer was easy to wind, but the important part was the oscillator. A Tesla coil is not just a transformer. It must be a virtually broadcast at close to radio frequency. When I fired up this coil, the output was over 2 million volts. I could hold a light in my hand, and it would glow. During judging, people from as far away as 5 miles complained of TV and radio interference. From past shows, get frequency in the bismuth metal layers. Mark's Van de Graaff generator will produce high voltage, but static charge is frequency independent. In other words, all over the place. And I doubt it would create the lift that he needs. He should drop the Van de Graaff idea and stick with a Tesla coil.
Well, I suppose the one point that he's missed here is that the electrical power that's going into the Tesla coil is first coming from the Van de Graaff generator.
Huh.
Is going through the Tesla coil, which then steps up the voltage, and the voltage then goes from there to the capacitor section.
Okay, I've got you. In other words, you've got an additional stage of amplification, actually.
Now, because you have a rotating spark gap at the bottom of this, and because you're able to basically almost create it like a distributor in a car,
right,
you can time the pulse, the amount of electricity that goes to each one of the individual capacitors, which, if you look at the circuit diagrammatically, the Tesla coil circuit has each and every one of those capacitor sections sitting in parallel. But the point is that the rotating spark gap takes that electrical energy and drops it off at each one of those locations independently of the next. And that is, in fact, what you almost have to do is you have to have three equally spaced points of distribution so that you don't have more energy accumulating as the spark gap spins around the perimeter of its spark gap. See what I'm saying? Because as your energy level begins to rise, if you only have one point where the energy goes out to those individual capacitors, basically this thing will begin wobbling like an off-balance top.
No, I've got you.
Okay?
I've got you. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark McCandlish. Hello.
Hey, it's Josh Price from West Virginia.
You are at the moment.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment and question. Basically, it's very horrifying, like, the powers that Iraq have with, like, these, what was that one bomb, the scalar bomb?
Scalar weapons.
Imagine what they could do, and I was thinking, do you guys think this will lead to more, like, World War III or something? Because I was reading in the paper, Russia was saying, like, they ain't supporting us because, like,
actually, Russia, sir, has said that an attack on Iraq could well spark World War III, is specifically what they have said. And so, yeah, if those kind of weapons were used, you can only imagine that it would cause a response, if not of a similar sort, then of a nuclear sort. I have no idea, but sure, we could be staring down the barrel of World War III.
Sure.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark McCandlish. Hello.
Good morning, Art. This is Ed at KABC Land in
Los Angeles. Yes, sir.
Anyway, I find your guest very interesting, very informative. I like his technical descriptions. They're very good. I grew up here in Pasadena. My dad ran the, he controlled the press, the media, for a certain county organization out here. And in the 60s, I was one of the first people at the age of about 6 years old to see the SR-71, and the press was handled to keep it away from the public and to not talk about the sonic booms and stuff like that. And, you know, that kind of verifies it. But at the same time, you know, his father worked in the aircraft industry and stuff, and there were a lot of German people, and there's this lot of baloney going around about UFOs coming out of Roswell. Well, in 47, you had all these German scientists like Wernher von Braun, the man who started Star Wars, came to JPL, NASA, things of this nature, and I think that's just kind of being glazed over for this UFO stuff.
All right, well, actually, it's a worthy question, the German connection, Mark, to what we're doing now.
Well, there have been an awful lot of allegations that were made that the Germans, right towards the end of the Second World War, had actually stumbled upon the same technology, and it's perfectly plausible if you consider that they probably had this just like we have spies. They may have had people who were even spying on Thomas Townsend Brown and Professor Biefeld regarding their experiments with capacitors in the 1930s, which, of course, predates the Second World War. So it's entirely possible that they may have stumbled upon this same effect, that they may have tried to exploit it in the form of saucer-shaped craft, and there's certainly a... So it's entirely possible that they may have stumbled upon in the form of saucer-shaped craft, and there's certainly a lot of stories that have come up in the last 5 or 6 years that allege that they did in fact have vehicles of this kind. Although there have been allegations that a lot of the photographs that was associated with this story were hoaxed photographs. Now, there was a young fellow who's a friend of Sean David Morton's, and I forget his name. He built that fusion rocket that flew to Area 51, and he knew...
David Adair.
David Adair. There we go. He has said, and so has Sean Morton, that... you know, there were, in fact, a lot of scientists that had been part of Nazi Germany that were brought over to America and employed for their expertise in rocket propulsion. But there is also a possibility, particularly when you consider that, you know, 1967, the date that I kind of earmark as the first date that I can find evidence for a military-based anti-gravity propulsion system is only 20 years after 1947 and the end of the Second World War. There are some people who allege that we even had systems functioning at a very basic level as early as 1963, but I haven't seen any of the evidence that would substantiate that. So I'm just going based on... composite drawings that I've done and sketches that I've made based on accounts that go back as far as 1973 and match those with military photographs taken in central Utah, near Provo, Utah, in 1967, which exactly match every one of the features of these same vehicles that were described as so-called alien reproduction vehicles that first serviced in 1967, which, by the way, happens to be the same year that one of the people who worked with Thomas Townsend Brown patented a system for a flying saucer that looks exactly like the so-called alien reproduction vehicle.
What a coincidence. Mark, you've been so good. I want to, before this hour ends, I want to give you an opportunity. I know that you have some materials that you can send out to people, but I don't know what.
Well, in the past, I've done that, and you know what? I found it to be rather labor-intensive, and it didn't provide me as much of a return as I really felt that it should have in terms of the amount of time involved.
Okay.
I do have, however, I am willing to put together a reading list of the many technical papers that are available, because, believe me, the people who have received the information that I've sent them in the past have indicated that it is extremely advanced, highly technical, and it's over the head of most of the people who've asked for it. So what I can do is, you know, if they want to send me an envelope, a self-addressed envelope and a dollar for my time, I'll Xerox a reading list off for them, send it back to them. The address would be Mark McCandlish, M-A-R-K, M-C, capital C, A-N-D, L-I-S-H, and the address is 2205 Hilltop Drive, number 158, and that's in Redding, California, and the zip code here is 96002. I can repeat that if you like.
Please.
Okay. It's Mark McCandlish, 2205 Hilltop Drive, number 158, in Redding, California, 96002. Now, there are a number of people who I've lost track of that I've corresponded with in the past that I'd like to reestablish contact with, and if they're listening, I'd like to talk to them again. Art, once again, I'd like to say it's been a real honor and a pleasure to be on your program. I only wish we'd had more time.
Well, we do have more time. We have an hour. I wanted to get that information.
Oh.
I wanted to get that information out before we finished up this hour. No. We've got
to... Well, if we have a couple of minutes, I'd like to just mention briefly the reason I brought up fiber optics involved in the Roswell thing. The reason for that is that what happens when you create a system like this anti-gravity propulsion system that cancels the mass of the vehicle... The first thing that happens is that it cancels the mass of the electrons that are flowing through the electrical system in the vehicle, and all your control parameters go right off the scale because everything has suddenly become the most perfect high-temperature superconducting circuit you could hope for. You don't have to use liquid nitrogen. You don't have to do anything special because you've basically canceled the mass of the electrons so they flow through the wires with no resistance whatsoever. Multiplying the efficiency of the electrical systems in the vehicle maybe 100 times, who knows. One of the things that happens is, as a result of that, is that when you put in a control input in an electrical circuit that has suddenly gone superconducting, it's going to change your ability to be able to control the vehicle. In fact, this may be the reason why some of the first prototypes that the military tried to engineer actually crashed because they weren't prepared for this eventuality.
Mark, when you build this prototype and get ready to test it, I sure would like to be there.
Well, you're invited. In fact, I'll take you for a ride if it works.
But let me
just tell you this. The most recent issue of NASA Technical Briefs that has been published describes a system that was developed for Pasadena Jet Propulsion Laboratory by some scientists working out of Caltech or the California Institute of Technology. And it describes exactly this kind of a system that allows you to use fiber optics and lasers to control other systems, to have sensors that send you data back to your computer or whatever it is you have within the system. And the reason you want to do that is because photons, the very substance of laser light, have no mass. And so when you kill the mass of the vehicle, it's affected in the control information that you send out when you move your control stick, the information that comes back from the various subsystems in the vehicle, none of that is affected as long as you use laser light or photons as your medium of transferring information from one part of the vehicle to the other.
There is an absolute relationship between the kind of propulsion system that you're talking about, anti-gravity propulsion, and time travel.
That's right.
They are virtually the same thing, aren't they?
Well, in a sense, they are. For anybody who's technically oriented and wants to track this down, a document that was prepared by a gentleman by the name of Miguel Alcubierre in 1994. It was published in Classical Quantum Gravitation, Volume 11. And it basically describes the concept of a warp drive. And doing that within the confines of general relativity without violating it. And it talks about creating a space-time bubble around your vehicle, where space-time is expanded behind you and compressed ahead of you.
All right, listen, we're going to have to hold it on that note. The hour is over. I've got to pay attention to the clock. Mark McCandlish is my guest, has been my guest, and will be for one more hour in some markets. I'm Art Bell from the High Desert. This is Coast to Coast AM.
If you...
With Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nye from outside the U.S., first, dial your access number to the USA, then 800-893-0903. If you're a first-time caller, call Art at 702-727-1222. From east of the Rockies, 1-800-825-53. Rockies, including Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico. Call Art at 1-800-618-8255. Or call Art on the wildcard line at area code 702-727-1295. This is Coast to Coast AM from the Kingdom of Nye.
By the way, the Kingdom of Nye is Nye County, Nevada. I get a lot of email about that. And speaking of email, if you want to send me some, you can. It's artbell@aol.com. That's ARTBELL, lowercase, @AOL.com. I get a lot of email. For example, Art, every night I check your live studio cam. And you always have a different T-shirt on. How many do you have anyway? Have you ever considered wearing a suit or maybe even a tuxedo? You've really lost your mind out there. If you worked at home and had a studio at home, would you, to do a five-hour talk show, wear a tuxedo? Really lost your mind out there. Staying up too late, not enough sleep. 7-2. This is Axe. Hello, Art. Great program. Congratulations. Do us a big favor. A couple of times, a number of the cassette tapes for this program. All right. Yes, you can order cassette tapes of this program or any program you hear us do with a guest, generally. And the number is 1-800-917-1222.
1-800-919-4278. I repeat, 1-800-917-4278. That's a couple of mentions. All right, Mark, welcome back.
Hi, Art.
Let us go to the phones and concentrate as best we can on them. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark McCandlish.
Hi, Aaron.
Hello. Where are you?
Believe it or not, just a few miles from Mark.
Okay, that's fine.
I thought Mark would enjoy this. A friend of mine is a pilot. He flies the Aurora. And I thought I'd tell you a few things about it that are fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, it goes about 26,000 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm. About Mach 17, right?
He can be anywhere on the planet in less than 30 minutes.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It takes off in less than 150 feet, goes straight up. You count to 15, and it's over 100,000 feet. He also asked me, I gave him some information. They've already had over 20 ground crew killed from touching the airplane when it came back, before it was apparently grounded out. It runs on extremely high electrical energy.
Mm-hmm.
And when it takes off, it's practically silent. I haven't seen it, but a lot of my friends have told me about it.
Mm-hmm.
And
actually, this doesn't sound like the Aurora. This actually sounds like some sort of an anti-gravity or electrostatic propulsion system.
Well, it looks like an Indian arrowhead, they tell
mm-hmm.
me, is what it looks like.
Okay.
And you're convinced, Mark, we have that technology?
Oh, yes, I'm sure of it. In fact, I think one of the stories I told you in an earlier program was meeting a fellow who actually worked at Plant 42 in Lancaster and Palmdale, who during a smoke break one evening, middle of the week in 1992, saw a large black disc-shaped vehicle land just outside the Lockheed Skunk Works at the southwest corner of Plant 42, that it was covered by a series of similar to these cherry picker vehicles that the electrical servicemen work on power lines with, each of which had a kind of tarp from the cherry picker basket, and they covered the whole thing up, rolled it into the hangar. And he indicated that a week later he saw this same vehicle emerge, that it was uncovered by the tarps, that after a period of time it rose silently to about 500 to 600 feet off the ground, and after hovering there silently for about 10 minutes, rocketed, well, that's not the right term, it shot away as though it had been fired out of a cannon with absolutely no noise whatsoever. Past him, he said he was about a quarter of a mile away, and it's past him and disappeared out of sight in under 2 seconds.
All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Mark McCandlish. Hello.
Hello, Art. How are you doing?
I'm fine.
I had a question for you. My name's Kurt. I'm calling you from Grass Valley, California.
Yes, sir.
I listen to you on KNCO radio.
Right.
That's not too far from Beale Air Force Base, is it?
I was just going to comment on that. I overlook Beale Air Force Base. I'm approximately 10 miles from it, probably about 5 air miles. And noticed all kinds of weird craft throughout the years. I've lived here for almost 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
I followed the SR-71, the stealth bomber, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And last night, I happened to see this craft last night that shot across the sky, stopped somewhat in the vicinity of Beale Air Force Base, and then took off like a bat out of hell again.
What direction was it traveling in when it came in, and what direction was it traveling in when it left?
I would say it was coming from the east, and it'd be from the east and then shot off towards the west.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's just coincidental, by the way, that there have been a lot of UFO sightings in the vicinity of Clear Lake, which is due west of Beale Air Force Base,
right,
out near the
right.
coast.
Mm.
In fact, you sound like somebody I would like to correspond with. If you got that address, drop me a line.
Okay, I do have an email address if you want that.
Just include it in a letter.
Okay, I will do that.
All right, great. Mark, do you have an email address?
At the present time, no, but I can tell you that because of the complexity of the Tesla coil that I'm going to need to use on this, I'm definitely going to have to get a computer, and there are already a number of pieces of software available from the International Tesla Society that will allow me to develop the, I guess, 48 different parameters that you need to know about when you're building a large Tesla coil so it doesn't fry you.
Yeah. All right, well, I'd like to apologize. Apparently, we broke your server. People are getting a 503 error, too many users.
Oh, really?
So your server must have a limit, and apparently we reached it for you. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Mark McCandless. Hello.
Hi, this is Tom in Reno, Art.
Hi, Tom.
Mr. McCandless, I have a couple of questions.
Go ahead, Tom.
If a scalar-type weapon were to be used against us, could you use a source like the HARP to generate a cancellation wave, effectively neutralizing the intersecting point of the interference patterns in the pulse?
Well, you know, I've actually speculated about that, and in fact, I talked to one of the leading experts on scalar weapons, a gentleman by the name of Thomas Bearden, who lives near Huntsville, Alabama, and he told me, and this is probably about a year ago, that he did not feel that the HARP system had any hope of interfering with scalar system.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he felt that it was really operating on a completely different principle. So in answer to your question, no, I don't think that it would help us.
Too bad.
Yeah, really.
All right. Thank you very much, caller. Take care. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark McCandless. Hello.
Hi, my name is Mike. I'm calling from Morgan Park, Minnesota.
Hi, Mike.
Which is pretty close to Lake County, actually.
Yep. Yes. Oh, the famous Lake County abduction.
McPherson's.
Film.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'd just like to make a correction about the J.P. Morgan dying on the Titanic.
Oh, okay.
Actually,
there was some benefactor of Tesla's that did die on the Titanic. I know that, but it may not have been J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, J.P. Morgan actually had plans to go on the Titanic in 1912,
mm-hmm.
but he was too ill to do it. So he actually died in Rome in 1913,
uh-huh.
the next year. So.
Okay.
So that's what happened to...
All right. Well, we appreciate the correction.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you. But there was a benefactor on the Titanic.
Yep. That's right.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark McCandless. Good morning.
Hi. My name is Jeff, and I'm in Central.
I can just barely hear you.
I can barely hear you, too, Jeff. You're going to have to yell at us.
Is that better?
Where are you?
I'm in San Bernardino, California.
All right.
About 5 miles from Norton Air Force Base.
Oh, my old stomping grounds.
Yeah.
I used to live in Rialto.
Well, cool. Then you know where I'm talking about.
Yes.
I work out at the concrete plant that's out at the
east. So you're right off the end of the runway.
Yeah. And I guess it was probably about 1989 or so. Had a real early start time.
Mm-hmm.
And me and about three of the other drivers saw this aircraft take off. And it was going so fast. Well, actually, the only thing I really noticed about it was the wheels,
mm-hmm.
the landing gear.
Right.
They looked like they had, like, steel braid on them.
That's right. You're exactly right.
Am I close?
The aircraft you're talking about is the Aurora.
That was
the one.
Well, what do you know?
That show.
Okay.
And it was November 12th, 1988.
Well, there you go.
You're welcome.
Does anybody have a... I keep getting sent photographs of supposed auroras.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what an aurora should exactly look like, so I don't know when I'm getting a real photograph.
Well, the vehicle that he was describing there just a minute ago is the one that had the kind of flattened-out football shape. And the reason for the braided stainless steel mesh that basically made up or simulated the tires was because of the extreme heat that the airframe is subjected to traveling at 26,000 miles per hour or, you know, Mach 17 or somewhere above that speed. The entire vehicle is covered with the same kind of heat ablating tiles like you would find on the space shuttle.
Uh-huh.
And the fuel system consists of what they call slush hydrogen, or it's almost like hydrogen that's been compressed so much that it's not even a liquid, it's more like a milkshake. And this this material is pumped through the skin of the vehicle to try and keep it from burning up, in spite of the fact that it has space shuttle tiles all over it. That same heat is used to liquefy the fuel and then eventually atomize it before it's injected out through those little fuel ejectors that are on the outer surface. But the individual that I spoke to who was at this presentation that involved Senator Cranston and Congressman Georgie Brown Jr. Actually had an opportunity to walk under this vehicle, and he said that it had 121 vertical launch tubes for nuclear reentry vehicles on the underside of this craft. And the system for launching these nuclear reentry vehicles was so elegantly simple, it just defies description. But I'll give it to you in the basic. There is a circular tile on the outside of the vehicle with explosive bolts around its perimeter. Mm-hmm. Up underneath that is a three-piece fiberglass sabot or spacer that holds a triangular-shaped reentry vehicle that is pointing down. Up inside the tube and directly above the reentry vehicle is another circular tile, just like the one on the outside. And behind that is a big coiled spring, just like you'd find in the suspension of a car. When you fire off and release this nuclear reentry vehicle, or even a conventional munition that's in this kind of a terminally guided munition, the external tile blows away, is carried away by the supersonic airstream. The reentry vehicle emerges from the tube, the three-piece sabot or spacer blows away, the cone stabilizes in the airflow, just like tossing an ice cream cone out the window of a car, and immediately the second tile that's behind it slams down into place and immediately reinstates the perfect aerodynamic surface that was there before with no turbulence.
Wow.
And it does that in like a tenth of a second. And it's got 121 of those babies inside.
Mark, don't you worry that describing in detail the way you are a lot of these things is going to cause somebody to come knocking on your door?
Well, you know, the problem is that, you know, I think the first time I talked about this kind of stuff with you was in 1994.
Right.
And although there were some pretty strange things that have happened to me in the meantime, you know, strange power failures, alternators in my car blowing out, somebody running me off the road. You know, nobody's ever taken a shot at me. I haven't had any threatening phone calls since that time. Quite frankly, if somebody was interested in finding out how I know what I know, I'd be happy to tell them. It's just that I don't feel comfortable disclosing actual names of sources over the air.
I understand.
For obvious reasons.
Sure.
But, you know, I would just soon be recruited into a program and get to play with this stuff rather than sit around speculating.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
I do. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark McCandlish. Good morning.
Art?
Yes.
I'm glad to hear you're back hale and hearty, boy.
Good. Where are you?
This is Dave, and I'm in the boondocks just south of Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
I have a question for you and one for Mark. Mark, do you know John Hutcherson?
No, I don't.
He is a scientist in Canada who has already developed anti-gravity. I saw it demonstrated.
How long ago?
Well, it's probably 88, maybe 87.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, I got a little communique that said the Canadian government went in and stripped his laboratory dry, took everything.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that was also done to Tesla. When Tesla passed away,
that's right.
I believe the FBI, was it the FBI?
That's right.
Went in and virtually took everything.
His notes, everything.
Uh-huh.
Well, I've heard this story before. You know, there's also a gentleman in Canada, and I don't recall his name offhand. I think the title of the book that was written about him was something like the Butterfly and the Concrete Man or something like that. I don't recall the exact name of it, but it described a similar event or series of events where a gentleman seemed to come into some information, and in this case he claimed it was from direct contact with some extraterrestrials or Pleiadians or something, and gave him a very simple system for creating a vehicle using an anti-gravity propulsion system, and that he actually built something that worked, and it flew away and nobody ever saw it again, and all the efforts to try and reproduce that initial experiment have failed since then, from what I understand, but he had some people show up in dark suits and basically walk right in.
Mm-hmm.
They appeared to be civilian, did not present any kind of identification. They actually appeared to be some kind of upper echelon corporate officials of some kind. But,
well, you know, anybody who doesn't believe that we have the equivalent of the now infamous Men in Black are out of their minds. They're out of their minds. Obviously, a government mm-hmm. would have to have some sort of organization that would control technology that was being developed in the private sector that might be competing with what we have done.
Sure. Well, you know, I look at David Adair's story where they basically footed the bill for all the experiments that this brilliant young man was attempting to do, and save for the fact that he objected to their desire to turn his system into a first strike capability. He might have been recruited right at that moment once he proved the success of his beliefs and his system as he had theorized it. He probably could have had carte blanche as far as where he wanted to work and what he wanted to do.
Well, you can generally believe that once the U.S. military gets involved, their motivations are not going to be to end the use of fossil fuels or something like that. They're going to be looking for military application. And if they find it,
yeah. Well, it's completely understandable. I have an associate who's told me point blank that the people that he has discussed this topic with have told him in no uncertain terms that unleashing this kind of technology on the economy of the world would lead to a worldwide collapse within 6 months and a nuclear war within a year.
Okay, then I guess we'll just have to hold it secret. And we'll also have to break. It's the bottom of...
To talk with Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nye, from east of the Rockies, dial 1-800-825-5033, 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, including Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, 1-800-618-8255, 1-800-618-8255. Now again, here's Art Bell.
Good morning, Mark McCandless is here, everybody. No time to be young. Isn't that the truth? No time to stay up late and listen to talk shows night after night, right? How about Real Talk? That'll take care of your problems. Real Talk is an AM-FM radio. It is digital. It's black. The readout is white. It has an AC power cord, so you can plug it in, or it runs on batteries as well. It's got a built-in clock, digital tuning, microphone and headphone jack, sleep timer, one-touch recording, and best of all, built into this incredible machine is a one-quarter speed tape deck. Now, that means that, say, take a 110-minute tape. Normally, it would yield 55 minutes of record time on one side. But, because it's Real Talk, you get nearly 4 hours on one side instead of just 55 minutes. Or nearly 8 hours on both sides. That's Real Talk. So if you're sick of missing talk shows, this is the only way to go. Now, we sell it at the same price that everybody else does, $149.95, but we have a better deal. We include shipping and handling free of charge, very non-trivial amount of money. We also include a high-quality 110-minute tape that you can use again and again. So if you want to buy it somewhere else, fine, go ahead. If you want the best deal, it's right here, $149.95. Also, they've got the pocket-size personal quarter-speed player for Real Talk at $64.95. This little guy runs on a couple of AA batteries. So, that means you can take the tape from the Real Talk and put it into this small hand-sized player if you want to. The number to call for either one or both of these items in the morning at 7:30 a.m. is 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. Are you having arthritis pain? Would you like to stop that pain in your joints now? glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate can help. With the Arthritis Assist formula, you can get them at a fraction of what you'd pay in stores. Plus, the Arthritis Assist formula contains another revolutionary nutrient that's helped many people in Europe, gelatin. Gelatin's full of the same kind of protein found in cartilage, the stuff that cushions your joints so they don't hurt. As we age, most of us get arthritis and our cartilage begins getting brittle. Studies show that gelatin nutritionally supports cartilage regeneration. Gelatin, along with glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate, are found in the Arthritis Assist formula. Stop those aches and pains without drugs by using all natural Arthritis Assist. Here's the offer. Order a 90-day supply of Arthritis Assist and you'll get a pain relief cream that provides immediate relief to your joints absolutely free. Call 1-800-232-5665. It's guaranteed to work or your money back, and you can't get it in stores. Call now, 1-800-232-5665. You've got nothing to lose but the pain.
Oh, this is really, really interesting. Mark from the New York Times, December 14th, 1944. The headline was, "Floating Mystery Ball is New German Weapon." Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force, December 13th. A new German weapon has made its appearance on the Western Air Front. It was disclosed today. Quote, airmen of the American Air Force report they are encountering silver-colored spheres in the air over German territory. The spheres are encountered either singly or in clusters. Sometimes they are semi-translucent. End quote. New York Times.
Well, that sounds like one of the first accounts of the so-called Foo Fighters that were seen throughout the Second World War. And although the stories of Nazi-built or German-built UFOs have persisted over the years, there have been a number of people who said that they never could account for those silver spheres that seemed to zip in and out of aircraft formations throughout the war.
Exactly. You know? All right, here's one more little item for you. All right, the man who died on the Titanic, the man who funded Tesla was Van Buren. According to Titanic myth, he asked for a brandy and sat in the ballroom while the ship sank.
I think they've incorporated that into the movie, too.
Yeah, it may be.
Something about dying with dignity, I think.
Uh-huh, what a movie that was.
Mm-hmm.
First time caller line, you're on the air with Mark McCandlish. Hello?
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 Yes, this is
I can
Katie.
Barely hear you, dear. You're going to have to yell at us.
I'm sorry, this is Katie.
Where are
Katie.
You?
In Arkansas.
Arkansas, okay.
Well, I just wanted to say that my mother and I'm kind of nervous because it's kind of hard to talk about. We're in kind of the rural part of Arkansas.
Right.
And we were up here and looking at the stars and everything, because there's supposed to be a meteorite and everything, and we were watching it. Last time we saw this cluster of stars, and it was like, I don't know, a triangular shape, but it was, I mean, it was just like stars.
Mm-hmm.
But they blinked at the same time.
Sure.
And they were going away from us, and, you know, I was just kidding around, and my mom and I were watching, and I said, hey, we're over here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Last time it came towards us, I mean, got right up to us, and now I was, like, getting scared.
How big do you think this thing was?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, I mean, it had to be huge, because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it looked about, probably about, let's see, probably about 10 stars together. And you know how stars are away from you. I mean,
sure.
They're big,
mm-hmm.
looking. And I mean, and then I was like, no, I'm just kidding. Go away, go away. You know, I mean, I got petrified. My mom was like, just calm down. It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, did you see that? And she goes, yes, I did. And I said, I don't want that. You know, and it went away.
Mm.
I mean, it...
Were you ever able to pick out a silhouette of what the actual shape of the vehicle looked like?
It looked triangular.
Mm-hmm. Was it an elongated triangle, or was it like an equilateral, three equal sides?
Well, probably equal.
Okay.
All right, well, there you go, from rural Arkansas. I mean, that I could sit here and take report after report like that.
True. Just for her edification, one of the eyewitnesses that I've spoken to who saw a similar vehicle near Plant 42 in Lancaster in 1987 indicated that she had seen multitudes of little lights on the belly of the vehicle as it passed overhead that seemed to be passing across its underside at about the same pace as the star background was moving behind it, so that it gave the illusion of, well, sort of a starfield camouflage, if you will. You really couldn't see it unless you could pick out the silhouette of the craft itself.
All right. Here's somebody who writes and wrote earlier, "Art, I'm still having a problem with the Van de Graaff generator. There's no way you could use it as an input to a Tesla coil. Please ask Mark what kind of component can take close to a million volts and static at that as an input. No transistor or tube I'm aware of. In the Tesla coil I built, we had to search all over to find an old military tube that could oscillate several hundred volts, which was applied to the primary windings. The secondary winding became an antenna. Unless alien technology can provide such a component, he'll have to bring it up to frequency before the voltage is stepped up." See what he says.
Well, it's all pretty technical, but the coils that were described on the vehicle that my friend saw were copper windings that were a quarter of an inch in diameter. They were separated and cast within a circular ring made of a light green translucent plastic with almost a three quarters of an inch spacing in between each one of the individual coils. Now, that's in just the primary windings. The windings in that part of the Tesla coil are actually fewer than in the secondary windings, which are usually of a smaller gauge wire, usually placed much closer together, and, you know, four times more windings than you would find in the primary section of the Tesla coil. Now, it's my understanding that one of the things that's incorporated into that central column is something very similar to a vacuum triode, which is a form of amplifier and oscillator.
Uh-huh.
And it uses a mercury vapor under an extreme vacuum. And the tube that it is housed in is a type of fused quartz.
Okay, that now, makes sense.
Now, you know, this may in fact be the component that he is trying to would have to be there. Yeah.
Okay, I've got you. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Mark McCandlish. Hello.
Hello. Calling from Spokane.
Yes, sir.
KGA.
KGA.
In 1908, in Tunguska, there was a explosion that destroyed 1,000 square miles.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to know if you thought possibly that could have been Tesla experimenting with his version of this EMP thing.
Well, as it turns out, there is actually an episode of the program called Sightings, which dealt with that particular subject, and I think they made a pretty good argument for the idea that Tesla had begun to lose funding for this power transmission system that he was building at Wardenclyffe.
Mm-hmm.
And although it didn't look as though he was going to be able to build it, he was hoping to find investors by making a demonstration of this system. And it is believed that he was trying to transmit a pulse of energy to, I believe it was Admiral Byrd, who was journeying to the North Pole at the time, hoping that this would somehow be witnessed by the expedition. But that the speculation in the article that I've read concerning this and the program that was aired on television suggests that Tesla had his coordinates off and that this pulse of energy actually came out of hyperspace over Tunguska and basically unleashed all the electrical energy that he'd pumped into it. Now, I have no idea whether it's true or not. I'm not even sure whether it would have been possible, but if you look at this in the same way as that earthquake machine that I described earlier, where you send out a pulse, in this case of electricity, and you find that resonant frequency of the earth itself, and then you pick a nodal point somewhere on it, like plucking a particular part of a guitar string, and you hit a particular frequency, you may in fact be able to get physical results at a distant location. And that may have been what happened, but I honestly couldn't tell you. I don't know.
All right. Traffic has eased a little bit, folks. And if you'll go up to my website and go down to the photograph of Mark McCandlish and click on his name, it will take you to his website. And now you can make it in. Or at least until enough of you hear this announcement and go up there and crash it again. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark McCandlish. Hello.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello. Mr. Bell?
Yes.
Mr. McEnglish?
Yes.
I've been researching this electrogravitic topic for quite some time. Oh, by the way, this is Carlos in Chicago.
Hi, Carlos.
And for one thing I've found is that photons actually have mass. If that was not the case, we would not have an electromagnetic spectrum, and there wouldn't be the high interaction rate that photons have. Otherwise, if they had no mass, they would be more like neutrinos.
Hmm.
Another thing is, I think that...
Did you discover this in a laboratory environment or mathematically?
This is reviewing the information, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Basic physics information.
Well, it is true that if a photon strikes certain materials, that it will basically decay or come apart, forming an electron and a positron, both of which have mass. So it does kind of make one wonder, how can a particle with no mass or a quantum packet with no mass yield two smaller particles that do have mass? It's an interesting
question. Well, it's because of the inertial field, you see, that they can interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
It is because of the mass that the brute force mass particles have, that the lighter particles, such as photons, have, that make it possible for them to interact with each other, like two particles having, you know, mass and their inertial field forming a gravitational field between them.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that I noticed that Tom Bearden has said in some of his papers is that a photon is basically just an electron that has, as he calls it, ortho-rotated out of this reference frame or this dimension by 90 degrees. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not sure if that helps to answer part of your question, but it may suggest that a photon is actually an electron that's sort of hovering on the fringe of this dimension before passing into hyperspace.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark McCandlish. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, Art. Mark.
Hi. Yes. Where are you, sir?
I'm doing fine.
No, I say, where are you?
Oh, I'm in San Diego. I'm sorry.
Fine in San Diego. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I have three quick statements and questions. Well, actually, maybe a little bit more. One, your fellow that needs the parts for the Tesla coil,
mm-hmm.
If you want to keep me on the line, I can help him out.
Well, I can't keep you on the line, so okay. You'll have to contact him. We gave his address. We'll give it again.
Okay. Second of all, what the last fellow said, I generally agree with. Now, back to what I had to say is, you had a person on the air, what, two nights ago, about the transcapacitor?
Yes, Jack Schumann.
Yeah, he's using the same technology, I believe, that we're talking about here for the time machine. So you should...
You may be right about that.
I think you're right. The thing is, okay, I built my time machine, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you push it off from? Because once you're off planet Earth, there's a lot of empty space out there.
And moreover, how quickly do you accelerate? These are all good questions. How do you control the rate of acceleration?
Well, I haven't got any. Well, if he's speaking in terms of anti-gravity propulsion functioning as a time machine while considering special relativity, then I would say that basically you are where you think you are, and based on what you can see. But you have to remember that in special relativity, the flow of time is also determined as a factor of what a person at the point of departure sees when all of this occurs. That is to say that the guy who's in the spaceship leaving supposedly at the speed of light may see one thing. The guy on the ground is going to see this vehicle rocket away like it was fired out of a rifle.
Okay. Before we run out of time, if you'll send Mark McCandlish a self-addressed stamped envelope, number 10 probably, and $1, he'll send you a reading list of all the kind of stuff he's been talking about. It goes to Mark McCandlish at 2205, 2205, Hilltop Drive, number 158, number 158, in Redding, California, zip code 96002. By the way, Mark, is it raining there still?
Oh, it has been. In fact, the ground outside is like oatmeal with... with AstroTurf on top.
Yeah, we're also getting rain here in the desert and have been for hours.
Well, you know, I'd like to mention that anyone who's listening out there that has some technical expertise in fiber optics, lasers, high voltage electrical systems and things of that nature who might be interested in corresponding with me on the development of this system, love to hear from you. Particularly like to hear from that witness who is working at the cement plant off the end of the runway there at Norton Air Force Base also. I'd like to correspond with him. And, of course, anybody who believes that they've been a participant or a victim of the abduction phenomenon, who thinks they may have seen some components of a propulsion system, and I'm talking about bona fide cases here, not people who are just into escapism, I'd like to hear from them also.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Mark McCandlish. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Turn your radio off, please.
I just hit the button.
Good for you. Where are you?
Dallas, Texas.
All right.
And I wanted to mention, I called earlier when David Adair was on, and I wanted to mention to this researcher here that these two articles that were in the Mechanics Illustrated, June and July, they were in 2 months together, 1957. And the first one was titled Anti-Gravity Power of the Future by G. Harry Stein. And it mentioned several researchers, Bell and Crookes, William Crookes and Townsend T. Brown, mentioned several universities that were working on it, major universities, major aircraft, aerospace companies. And they were talking about using a condenser. In connection
a condenser is the same as a capacitor.
Yeah.
And it just seems to me like they had just stumbled upon it maybe at this time in 1957, and then later on they decided to cover it up. Is that a possibility?
I think that's exactly what happened. I think they had a breakthrough. They found out how the system would work. And the interesting thing about the development of the system is that if you look at the way the components are oriented, the capacitors all pointing outward from the base of the Tesla coil, you find that the electrical field that's generated by the Tesla coil itself is also radially oriented like that. And so what happens is that in each one of the capacitors, you have the electrons that are stored as a potential there. They're all lining up like little soldiers in a line, almost like those ball bearings that you see in that little gift at the store where you take one out and you let it go and it hits back and forth. That is essentially the foundation of what is called a scalar wave. In 1903, a gentleman by the name of Edmund Whittaker wrote a paper indicating that if you could modulate a scalar wave, that it would resonate everywhere in the universe simultaneously, which right there and then the guy was basically saying superluminal or faster than light speed communication is possible. It's also one of the reasons why I think it's being incorporated into this propulsion system, and I also think it's one of the reasons why the SETI program, as it's currently structured, is never going to find any interplanetary communications with aliens, because they're listening with the entirely wrong type of ear, so to speak. They're listening for scalar transmissions rather than radio frequency transmissions that are limited to the speed of light.
Right.
I just recently obtained a book that I had gotten on the advice of David Adair, Paul Hill. Have you heard of him before?
Oh, yes.
Unconventional Flying Objects.
Is his research, I haven't really had a chance to really go into it. Does he pretty much parallel what you're talking about with using the, it sounds like you use three components, the Tesla coil, a condenser, and a Van de Graaff generator, you said earlier?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I'm proposing. You could also try something like a Wimshurst electrostatic generator, which is the kind of thing that Fred Bell had talked about in his Time Machine. Paul Hill, in his book, goes through and analyzes a multitude of UFO cases and breaks down the evidence according to the kind of factors that it would answer from a technical perspective. That is to say, if you have a certain kind of radiation that's been detected in a certain case where there was a sighting, does that mean that this vehicle was emitting X-rays or gamma rays or what have you?
Mark, we are out of time.
Okay, well, anyway.
Show's over.
It's a good book.
It's been a good show.
Listen, my friend, thank you so very much.
It was an honor, Art.
We will do it again. Always too much to talk about, not enough time.
Really.
Thank you, my friend, and good night.
Good night.
That's Mark McCandlish, folks, and I hope you enjoyed it. I told you you would. I told you you would. All right, tomorrow night we'll be talking about Devil's Hole, which can be viewed on my website. We've actually got a picture of this hole. That's tomorrow night. To get a copy of what you just heard, call 1-800-917-4278. From the high desert, good night. Everybody listen.